Are there any things in Navajo culture which are important in maintaining the good health that you defined and talked about earlier? Are any of the rituals important, for example?
There are several ways to explain it, but it's rather, probably it's my, it's beyond my comprehension, but I'll try it in this fashion. I think Mr. Dalton pretty much touches on the cultural differences in terms of good health, that the self-respect, the self-reliance, where it balances for each individual. But there are times that you cannot always be balanced equally in all aspects or different stages of your life. There are times that you go here and there. Being in a major dominant society and being living in your own culture is pretty difficult to combine those two and be able to come out as a healthy person. There's always a conflict in various areas that you need to go through. Yes, and most of these, definitely most of these ceremonial activities that are conducted for individuals to correct some of these illness, for correct more or less preventive type of activities, so a person can go on, and more or less is a first aid for one part of the culture. The others are it's after effect that person's been ill, and the certain ceremonies are to be held to correct these symptoms or bring the person back into a total balance as he once lived. Does that answer your question, or did that confuse you?
I think that it's a good answer to a very large question. Dr. Bergman, do you want to say anything about interpersonal relationships as they relate to health among Indians in your experience?
I think I'd rather talk about people in general than about Indians, and my point of view is always conditioned by my experiences among Indians. I think one of the things that is important about Indian life, as at least it used to be led, and as it still is led to a large extent, is that people rely on their families and their friends a great deal. I like what Carl said, but I don't think that he would like to leave the impression that everybody has to be an absolute individual without relying on the people that he lives with. There is among non-Indian, certainly psychiatrists and people in general in this country today, a feeling that it's very wrong to remain close, for example, to your parents. People who have much regard for or stay connected with their parents are regarded as dependent and infantile and perhaps contemptible. Among Indians, that certainly is not generally. Among Indians,
Anglo, we must go through a ritual which is assessing the Anglo's reasons for wanting to touch us and if we in turn want to be touched by the Anglo. So I'm not saying that it's a total thing that we do not allow Anglos to touch us. You only touch us after you pass the test and we've given you permission to do so. Oh, we touch each other all the time. No, my question was, I said the health status is indeed deteriorating because the people we must depend upon for that touching procedure to heal us are predominantly Anglos, and therefore we resent that.
We might have time for perhaps one more question. I would like to, if there's not another question, I'd like to ask if anybody on the... All right. a big assignment, Mr. Dalton, to repeat the question, how would you define love, since you used the term and spoke about the importance of it in health? And,
I think Herbert first mentioned it, and then Mr. Dalton mentioned it as well.
That's right, it was Mr. Tallahassee.
Mr. Tallahassee, I was delighted that you asked Mr. Dalton. Mr. Dalton looked over here and was delighted that somebody else might respond. What is love? What did you mean by...
When I said that, you know, love is about the most important thing in a person than hate. Now, all these things cause a sickness. If you hate one another, you're always sick. If you worry about one another, you'll never get sick. And respect is another one. We have to respect each other in order to survive at any time whenever sickness is around. And I know you people understand what I'm trying to say. It's really hard to believe yourself whether you love someone or hate someone. But my advice to you now, as I would say, a farewell talk, my advice to you people is just to ignore some of the bad things, you know, that has been going around all the time. Eventually, it will cause sickness. So, we must respect ourselves and others. And we must love one another. Just like she mentioned a while ago, how he meets the people. That's another thing, too. You have to greet some people whom you know. You know, just see, this is the thing.
Thank you. That's sort of...
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Here.
Would you say, then, that love is healing?
Love is healing.
This what causes a lot of these things, you know, if you're sick and you love some people, and that will clear away all the sicknesses and everything. So, I and me and we work together on some of these things, you know, and sometimes we get kind of argue about things, you know. But when everything is over, he's my best friend.
I'm sort of glad. I think two of our panelists are leaving. We're going to have to wrap this up. But let me just say one thing first. Thank you very much, Dr. Bergman, Yazi. I want to thank all of the panel and all of you folks for being with us. We've just begun really to get into a very big area that we could go on and on about, but I hope we've all gained some additional dimension of understanding of how we can help each other in health and illness. Thank you.
That should give me enough time. I'm sorry that the time that was listed for me to be here did not fit into the scheme of things this afternoon. You really can't go through steel, no matter how hard you try. I'm under the impression right now, and I remember a professor telling me some years ago, if anything looks too good to be true, it probably isn't. And that's where I find myself with you today. I've had approximately 3 hours sleep in the past 36 hours. I had another engagement in Memphis, Tennessee, knowing that I had this one today, but I was so sure that American Airlines had their flights all, you know, sliced out so neatly that it wasn't possible for me to miss a flight. I should have left Memphis yesterday at 6:45. I left there at 11:55 last night. Got into Tucson at 2:15 this morning and up again at 6 o'clock. So I thought, well, Memphis was really neat. You know, it was a nice experience and so forth. So Arquasante will take the bad taste out of my mouth left by American Airlines. And then I get here this morning and find I'm pretty much where I started last night. You know, can't get in, can't find my way around. So what I'm sharing with you is I don't know what the state of my health is at this particular time. But I will tell you some things about myself that might help you in understanding where I am at this point in my life and how I arrived at that point. I was born in a small town about 30 miles east of Dallas, Texas. There was a very defined and isolated medicinal system within that community. And I was very much part of it because it was instituted and maintained by my grandmother, who was a spiritualist healer. I've often shared with audiences that I knew very little about health as it is or has been presented to me as a professional person. And that is where children are taught to brush their teeth every morning. I never used a toothbrush until I was 10 years old. I never had a cavity until I was 27 years old and the mother of three children. And I believe it occurred then because my standard of living, you know, had increased financially and I had begun to eat more of the traditional foods. And so here I end up with cavities. I was raised to know how to use prayer as a vehicle of getting my needs met, whether they were physical, psychological. In other words, I even learned to pray for my enemy. But the prayer that I prayed for my enemy was sort of like casting a spell on my enemy so that his health would deteriorate, okay? I think, though, that when we talk about black medicine, we're talking about a system that has been maintained over 400 years simply for the reasons that blacks simply do not trust whites. When I say that, I say this, that mistrust is based on many things. It's attitudinal. It is also a behavioral response to Anglos. In the studies that I've done, I found that blacks many times will not take advantage of the traditional or contemporary healthcare system, even when the services are free. They refuse to because of the attitudes of the predominantly white staff or the health services or, you know, run by. Now, the thing about it is that blacks have been taught from a very early age a patterned response to any feedback that they get from a white. These rules are never written down. You have no way of knowing what the rules of behavior are in any situation that I might find myself in with you. I only know the rules. Another black would only know the rules. For instance, I'm a patient who comes into a clinic or a hospital. In some way, you, the white, violate my standards of basic courtesy. You don't know how you did that, because you don't know the rules of the culture. But you have violated what I consider standards of courtesy or just common behavior. So the outcome of that is that I don't come back to the clinic anymore. I avoid your presence. And this is what is happening in many healthcare systems. I know of hospitals around the country where the emergency room is the only vehicle of treatment that blacks will seek because they do not want to be in long-term contact with white nurses or doctors. This then requires some type of ethno-medicinal system within your own culture. You are just as sick as any other patient who is admitted to the hospital, but as a black, you do not want to be admitted to the hospital. So you have three avenues within your own culture. You can seek out the grandmother or an elderly person within your kinship chain for home remedies. Okay. When the home remedies have been exhausted and your condition has not improved, you then may seek the healer in the neighborhood, who again may be an older person, may be in the kinship chain, or may be affectionately known as aunt somebody or uncle somebody. Now, the thing that the healer has, in addition to the home remedies, is that they have the gift of laying on of hands. The other thing is that they may be more steeped, aware, and expert in mixing the herbs, spices, ointments, or whatever they use. The other form of the cultural medicinal system is the spiritualist. The spiritualist is the one who is sought when home remedies and the healer can no longer guarantee any type of improvement in the health status of the patient. Should that occur, the person then probably will believe he has been fixed or hexed. You can only be fixed or hexed by a loved one, by a jealous person, neighbor, friend, relative, or a lover of your husband or wife. Okay, this is how you're fixed. There are three avenues in which a person can be fixed: hoodoo, voodoo, and OB. OB is the deadliest of the three. It is one that is practiced highly in the West Indies, and it is believed that more of the psychological effect or the belief in it kills the person more than the actual procedure that is used to put the hex on the person. So I have found that the older the black client, the more apt he is to use all three components of the black health system. If one doesn't work, you try the other. And if all three don't work, then you might give the Anglo doctor a chance to diagnose your condition. What is being done with the diagnoses is that many of the black patients are going to the hospital, they've already made their own diagnosis, and they've already prescribed medications for themselves, and they just go to the hospital to see if the doctor comes up with the same conclusion they've already reached. Then, if they're given prescriptions, the patient then may use his home remedy in conjunction with a prescription that he has received, and the effect is not always one that we would like to see. It was found in Phoenix recently that some of the black patients who were admitted to Maricopa County Hospital were having adverse physical effects to the medication given by the doctor when the patient came in. And it was found out that what the patient took at home and what the doctor gave him just sort of clashed. As we said, it was antagonistic. The drugs did not mix. But there is no way that I know of eradicating black folk medicine. I heard a professor from Houston University say that folklore medicine is a transit type of system and will eradicate itself when the financial and educational level of that particular segment increases. I don't believe that. And I will tell you why I don't believe it. Because I am well aware that there are blacks who have reached an educational level that is conducive to paying the premium for health insurance, the wherewithal to seek a private doctor in the community, but they use the money for other things because they have a long time to catch up to the lifestyle that many Americans are enjoying. And so you find that the black family who has an increase in income will tend to spend that money more readily on the more materialistic things that they have liked for a number of years. It's more important to go out and buy a brand new living room set or a brand new car or a brand new refrigerator, those kinds of things, rather than invest the money in premiums toward Blue Cross, Blue Shield, or whatever other programs that might be available to pay for their health needs. the black health system, if you want to call it that, or black folklore medicine, whatever you want to label the medicinal system in the black culture, is maintained through three mechanisms that are inherently black responses and black attitudes. The first one is the black's assessment of all Anglos that he comes in contact with. The black's orientation to the Anglo is only of two major importance. One is acceptance or rejection. So the assessment is based then upon does this Anglo's body language, facial expressions, and verbal comments to me indicate that they are comfortable with blacks, that they do not have to in some sense justify their presence here with you. It is very easy to recognize when a white is uncomfortable with a black. You know, it's like reading a road map, okay? As one lady told me, to assess a white person by looking at their face, and if they get that old pinched look to their face, she says, honey, a nigga's in trouble. Okay? So I found myself using this assessment, you know, just how are you looking at me here? Are you really accepting what I'm saying to you? The other thing is then is after the assessment is made, whether you accept or reject the black, then the pattern responses come into play. Many responses that I make to Anglos today, I cannot tell you the year or the time that I learned them or who I learned them from or what age or in what geographical location I happen to be when I learned them. But I know it's there. I know that if I am hired as a domestic in a white household, that whites will tend to test my honesty by leaving money or things of value lying around the house. And in their interpretation, I'm supposed to pick it up because all black people steal. So therefore, I have been taught that if I'm going to clean your house, I don't care what you have laying here of value, I do not move it. I clean around it very thoroughly so that you will know that I know what you did and that you will then be aware I don't want your money or your jewels or whatever you have. So by cleaning very thoroughly around the object, you are aware that I know that you left this money here to test my honesty. Okay. If I should go in a department store and find that I am not waited on as rapidly as the Anglo customer, maybe because I'm in a portion of the department store that carries a very expensive line of clothes, and the sales lady doesn't wait on me, my response to that is to take a dress off the rack, take it to her, make her very aware that I am in this department store to buy your dress, but you don't seem to want to wait on me, so I'm going to show you the dress, give it back to you, and say, no, I don't want it. I was looking for something more expensive. Yeah. Even if the dress costs $300, I still tell her I'm looking for something more expensive and give her the dress back and walk out of the store. So there are very few situations that I find myself in with an Anglo that I don't have a pattern response, but I don't know where I learned that response. If you insult me in any way, or I sense that you are aware that you have insulted my intelligence or that you have in some way insulted me with a racial slur, I will forget your name. You no longer exist to me. If you insist on starting and maintaining a conversation with me, I will give you very monosyllabic answers. Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I don't care. But I will never call your name. It's as if you do not exist. Okay? Many times I will lead you on to make you think that I'm listening very closely to your advice, especially if you're the kind who knows what is best for blacks than any other black in the world. I will let you tell me about all these goody things, and then I will laugh at you. Or I will repeat what you said to another black, and we'll crack up, you know, that you think you're so smart, you know, and we ran a game on you, is really what happened. I'm the director of an associate degree nursing program, which is for two-year RNs. Out of 26 programs in the state of Arizona, I'm the only black director of any program. To this day, you will never make me believe that I did not have to work twice as hard as any other white director to get the directorship of the program, okay? But there are many days I find myself feeling very isolated. I really need contact from blacks. That creates problems. Blacks who have been educated in the dominant educational institutions are known as Oreos. A certain class of, many of you who don't know, that's black on the inside, white on the, black on the inside, white on the, you know, whatever. Black on the outside, white on the inside. But what I'm trying to say to you is that once you find yourself in that particular state, blacks don't want you and whites don't know what to do with you. So you find yourself a marginal person. You're just sticking out all the time like a sore thumb. You know, if I find myself in the company of nurses, even to seek a decent restaurant in Washington, D.C. or New York, guess who's the only fly in the buttermilk? Yeah, when we walk in the restaurant, there I am, you know. So many times this becomes very burdensome for me. I would like to just go back being a black. You know, whites say blacks are happy and laughing and we never look our age and we don't have any worries. Well, I'd really like to go back to being that black, you know, many days. When that really gets to be a problem, and I have 23 full-time faculty and 6 part-time faculty, and they're all Anglo, except 2 part-time black people that are hired in the program. And I sometimes feel that my faculty is still operating under the Aunt Jemima concept. There's Mama Bessie up there. Let's go tell her what our problems are, and she's going to kiss our knees and fingers and make it all better, and we won't have to think or accept any responsibilities for our own actions. When this becomes too much for me, I will say to the faculty, what's the matter? Do I have VD or something? Nobody comes to me until everything goes wrong. Or I will say to the faculty, damn, you people have more problems than any people I have ever seen. What am I doing out here trying to compete in this Anglo society? Hell, I'm black. I could go on welfare and drive a Cadillac. Okay? That's the way I vent my problems. But in a sense, to bring back the point I made to you a little bit ago, a person who then picks up my comment and attempts to lecture to me about the needs of the black person, I then run a game on that person. There's one particular person that each time I make the statement about being black, going on welfare, driving a Cadillac, she gets bent out of shape. She says, oh, no, you can't do that. Now, I don't know if you know it or not, but you have educated yourself out of the black culture. They really don't want you back. Now, I know about this study that says, you know, and generally I really get into it with her. I'm just there with my mouth open like, oh, no kidding? Really? Yes, I know. Now, there's no cohesiveness among blacks. You cannot expect to go back and be accepted even by your own people. When she runs down, I'll say, damn, I didn't know that, and I've been black all my life. How long have you been black? So this is what we call game running, and the game running is based on the response that we have received in our initial contact with the Anglo. And the second thing that I discuss with you is the response that I might give to you based on that initial assessment that I have made. Then I must come up with a solution. Now, how am I going to cope with what I just assessed and the way I just responded to you? There, as I've said before, I have two ways of going. I can refuse to enter an intellectual conversation with you. I can forget your name. And in the case of a doctor or nurse that I feel the solution is to remain apart from them, I go back and take my baking soda and 10 drops of turpentine on a teaspoon of sugar, or I may decide then to go to the market, get some pork chops, render the grease out, make me a nice ointment, pour some turpentine in it, rub it on my chest, put on my husband's flannel shirt, and go to bed. Okay? So that's really how black folk medicine is maintained. I'm not saying that it is correct, I'm not saying that it is helpful, because your studies will show that the health of the black community has deteriorated in relationship to the health status of other minority people in the United States. I'm a firm believer that that deterioration in the health status has been self-generated. Because if we look at statistics, the number of health care agencies that are available to these people in the communities in which they live, even the neighborhood health clinics and so forth, then we would say if the blacks in that community utilize the facility in the way that the program was set up, their health status would improve. Okay? So the doctors, the nurses, facilities, equipment, everything is there, but it is not utilized. I had a habit of going to the health care clinics in the neighborhood, and first of all, I have to tell you, because I am an Oreo, that the type of people I generally gather my information from do not accept me wholeheartedly. As one of them said, because I had been to the university, the same principle applied to me as putting a cat in the oven. You can't make biscuits. So in a sense, I am outside of the mainstream, and I use what I call status inequality, which separates me from the black who is making, say, less than $7,500 a year. I believe that's poverty level kinds of thing. Because what black is going to sit in his living room and rap to me about all the home remedies that they use when I'm sitting there talking like Queen Anne? Oh, isn't that, well, where did you learn that type of procedure? You see, they don't know where I'm coming from. As far as they're concerned, I'm being overly proper, and I'm acting like Miss Ann. In other words, I'm trying to be white. So the only way I can gather that type of information that I use in my articles and so forth is to really get down. I have to sit with Grandma and whoever, Aunt Susie or Aunt Jane. Ain't that the truth? Mm-hmm, honey, I sure know. Yes, you know, you can't trust white folks. Mm-hmm, yeah. That's true. They'll get you in a minute. You can't trust them devils far as you can see them. Now, that's a verbal pattern, okay? Another thing is, as I'm talking to you, I could probably talk to a black audience and half the time it takes me to explain to you what I'm talking about. Because blacks use less words to convey a total meaning in a half second than you do in five. If I do not approve of your response to me, all I have to do is look at another black and go, you know, and they got the message, okay? The other thing is that blacks are said to swear prolifically. We do. But with each other, we've heard you guys cursing. You guys sure are funny. You put all your words in the wrong place. You really don't know how to swear, you know? But when a black swears, we are swearing at gut level, man. We have a lot of feeling behind that, and that's the only word we know to really get that feeling out in the open. So I really had to learn to do those kinds of things. You know, I had to tear down the status and get back to grassroots. I did, and I enjoy it very much. But then my husband has difficulties because he cannot understand me when I get home. He says I talk very country. But honey, let me tell you, when you talk in country, it feels good. I don't have to remember ing on nothing, you know. And I can walk over nouns, sit down on pronouns, kick adjectives, you know, and squash all in words y'all talking about, because I don't have to talk that way, okay? Plus, I also have another way of talking, which if you talk that way to me, I break your neck, you see. But I can say, nigga. You know, and that in itself conveys a whole message. It's the way I said nigga, okay? The way I just said it is nigga, you know, like, I don't believe nothing you're saying, you know? Nigga, you know, I'm angry. Get down, you know, get off of there, you know, don't do that, you know? A very soft, hey, nigga, you know, it's a very loving term. So what I'm saying is that blacks have a system that is very functional, that is very satisfying, And we are running, and I put myself in the health profession now when I say we, because I am of the same culture as any other nurse. I have the same basic training, the same concepts were presented to me. I had to memorize them as any other nurse to pass the same board. And so I say we are ignoring a very rich, basic contribution from the blacks that we care for in the healthcare centers, because we are refusing to admit that they interpret their illnesses differently than we do. Man, I don't know what no cholelithiasis is, but if you tell me I got stones in the gallbladder, I dig. You know, I know where you're coming from. You know, don't walk up to me as a male patient with a urinal and talk about urinate. You're a what? You know, okay? There was a study done at Bellevue in New York, and it cites the instance of a black patient who came in. They thought he had a myocardial infarct, which can be very serious. The little nurse ran up with a urinal and she says, "Could you urinate for me?" You know, and she kept asking him to urinate. The patient gave no indication that he even heard. It's like he was deaf and blind. A young Jewish doctor who had been in the Harlem area and understood the street talk walks up to the dude and says, "Hey, man, pee." The dude said, "Yeah, I dig it." You know, but as long as the nurse was using this, you know, he did not understand. And I think that we have totally ignored a part of a culture that is very rich. Some of the remedies that blacks have been using over a number of years by simply, as I said, rendering down animal fats, going out behind the cow and picking up, you know, the cow chip after it's dry a couple days, going behind the sheep and picking up sheep droppings, heavily using baking soda, turpentine, coal oil, saltpeter is even used. There's a lot of salt being used for retention of teeth. They make saline water for washing the orifice, whether it be the nose or the eyes or the ears. Petroleum jelly is heavily used. And these people have been able to stay relatively well, regardless of the fact that we say, "Oh, turpentine, you should never ingest turpentine. You know, a certain level of turpentine is toxic." But blacks have learned how to use it judiciously and maintain their health. And I tell you right now, I make a lot of money. I sit in my own office. I got two secretaries. I got a beautiful home, a nice car. Everything that you people say, blacks got it all, what do they want, okay? I've got all those things that you say as a black I should want, and now I should back off because I have all these things. But I tell you one thing, before I go to the doctor, I'm going to my medication cabinet, and I'm going to look for me some baking soda if my stomach's upset. Or if I've had a cocktail that went down the wrong way, I'm going to take me a little baking soda and whip it up in some water and drink it and go to bed, okay? If I've got a toothache, I'm more apt to go and buy some saltpeter and pack that tooth, or some red pepper and pack that tooth before I go to the dentist. I didn't know for a long time what a tetanus shot was. And as a kid, I've had nails rammed completely through my foot from bottom to top. My grandfather simply poured coal oil on it, wrapped a rag around it. I never had lockjaw. See? And it's still being done all over the country. You do not see blacks in large numbers in your health centers in proportion to other people because, as I say, they are taking care of themselves, and they will continue to do that until the whites in the healthcare system learn to relate to black patients. I'm not saying that you have to communicate with us on our level, because like I told you, you sound funny when you try to talk like that. But I think if you could understand, you know, where we're coming from, and if you don't understand the usage of the word, be brave enough to say, "Well, I really don't know what you're talking about. You know, could you kind of give me some more examples? Could you spell it out for me? Tell me what it is you're really saying." Beg pardon? Oh, the other thing too is that to try to lower yourself to my communicative level is really beneath your level, and I know that. So I think it's rather foolish to engage in it. To attempt to communicate with me by, "Well, hey, blood, See, my first question is, what blood? What's your mother's name? You know, now I know my old man got around, but I didn't know he got that far around. You see, now that's my response to you. I'm not your sister. You know, I'm not your sweetheart or your honey. Come on, honey, take your pill. How many nurses have you seen in the hospital approach patients like that? You know, it's very false, it's very superficial, and it's readily picked up. And I hate it, and I generally will respond with a great deal of hostility. Okay? But black people are not always violent. We're not always hostile, you know. When I read a study that said most blacks carry knives and ice picks, I said, hell, let me hurry up and go get me one, you know, because I didn't know that's what I was supposed to do. You see, but that's what you tell me I'm supposed to do. By the same token, many times in a healthcare setting, you dictate my behavior because you always anticipate what I'm going to do based on your frame of reference of what a black should be, is, or is going to be. And I pick that up immediately and respond many times in the expected way. And sometimes just for the hell of it, I'll respond in an unexpected way, just to throw you off the track. Okay? My time is running out. I'd like to answer any individual questions that you have. Yes?
I had a couple of them, and I'll just say it again, and then you can respond to them. When you were talking about being called Mario and that kind of thing, someone that goes through an interracial marriage, a black with a white, Is that something that would be considered if the person is in a business or in a higher culture and is black and is married with a white, would they be considering them Oreo?
No, the black is lower than an Oreo. A black who is found in an interracial situation will find himself at a disadvantage in the black culture.
What about in the white culture?
It's the same difference.
What about the white person?
I think that you will find more hostility toward a black male, white female relationship. You will find total outrage at black female, white male. Because historically, that has been the pattern. And black men become highly upset when white men handle their women, just as white men become upset when black men handle their women. I think that in the right geographical area, in the right financial backing, that the marriage could succeed. But I think that the children have a very poor chance of ever making it in either culture. And I think that should be the main consideration, the child.
What about when you were talking about blacks, I'm not sure if I heard it right, but I always was under the impression that blacks were closer race than whites, and they greet each other all the time. The friends that I have, they're in the Midwest. They say hello and they greet each other. I don't notice that much with the whites. You know?
Did I greet you two ladies when I walked up today?
No. Well, because the friends that I have that, and I'm originally from the Midwest, just been here a few months. My friends that are black always greet each other, hello brother or whatever, and I notice this all the time. Maybe they're just friendly blacks.
I would be willing to bet that the blacks that you are with are in a certain economic strata. Are you familiar with any low socioeconomic blacks, or did the blacks that you know end up pretty much on the same financial or...
I'm working in centers, I've noticed this quite a bit more, and maybe I've just been in this grouping, lower, middle, or upper, that they sort of greet each other, say hello to each other, and I haven't really noticed that in all the whites, and it may just be the folks that I've been around.
I think that whites have a cohesiveness that is based on a financial basis. Blacks have a cohesiveness based on poverty, need, not having, wanting, trying to figure out and organize a planning action to meet their needs. That's where the strongest cohesiveness happens to be. When black power came into being, there were very few middle class or upper middle class blacks concerned with the revolution. It's only the blacks who need it badly that led the movement. But the saddest part is that they gained the opportunity then for the upper and middle class black to get the cream of the crop as far as jobs, education, and so forth are concerned. And the blacks that really opened the doors for us are still on the low scale. They died, they burned, they shot, they fought, they went to jail, they were slugged in the street, they were stomped in the street, and the sad thing is they're pretty much in the same position now after somewhat 10 or 12 years. So I would say that the blacks that you see hanging together are those blacks who really need to be together.
Yeah. I have to ask you, what is the medicinal value of aspidity?
Did you read my article by any chance?
No, I haven't.
I don't know that aspidity has any medicinal value, and I think that I've written about this before, and I don't know the composition of it, but I have a very good friend who's a pharmacist and a doctor at the U in the back of the room. Dr. Brewer, could you?
It's a psychological calmative, really. It's sort of the only psychological one, in fact, like a placebo. It has a powerful odor, and so anything that has a powerful odor you think is very potent or powerful. And it was used to keep people away from you so that you didn't catch communicable diseases. It has an offensive order, as a matter of fact.
Right.
So they wore it around the necks to keep contacts away when there were epidemics, and that it worked that prevented.
There was a question in the back.
Do you think that the breakdown in the health status of black people has to do with their moving into urban centers, breaking up of traditional family ties and stuff like that, and where there's no more dissemination of the home remedy information to the common people or to everybody, you know, where it's just kind of moved into a background position, whereas one time it was kind of the mainstay of almost everybody's health care?
No, I wouldn't say that it's moved into the background probably as much as we would anticipate as nurses and doctors, you know, that blacks have given up quite a bit of usage of the old-time remedies and so forth. As I said, I think that it has increased, and the surprising thing is that the usage of it has increased at a middle or upper middle class level in the black community, because the monies that could normally be utilized now that you're at a higher financial or income is utilized to buy materialistic things that you've always wanted but never had the opportunity to have. Okay. Did I answer your question pretty well? Okay. Yes.
What do you think in general is the view of the black with other minority people? Like, so far as the black and white, I mean, like, where do you think the other minorities would fall?
Why other minorities would follow blacks or...
No, in reference to, let's say, color. Because I've gotten from a few black people the response of, like you're white kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't buy that at all, so far as culturally.
Are you of Mexican-American?
Yeah.
Chicano? That's very interesting, because in Texas, the racist or prejudiced Texan tends to call a Mexican a nigga. He's just another nigga. He's brown. In the northern parts of the country, or even in the far southern portions of the country, where Mexicans might be relatively a new population to that area, say less than 50 or 60 years, they're more readily absorbed into the white culture than into the black culture. In border states like this, I think that there is a great competition between the Chicano and the black in many instances, because we're both fighting for the same kinds of things. Dignity, equal rights, you know, the right to make monies or whatever kind of thing. And I think that's where the competitive spirit is. I don't think that there's a basic hostility. I've seen Chicanos and blacks get along quite well in varied situations. The problem begins is when the Mexican American then decides that he would rather be more white than Mexican American. For instance, many of the Mexican American women are marrying Anglo men because of the extreme macho image that the Mexican male portrays. And so therefore the Mexican girl who is on her way up or desires or aspires to be up will marry an Anglo man. And then she is generally looked down upon by the black person, more so than if they were just in the same school or whatever.
What about an interracial kind of situation, the minority?
You know, that's very interesting, because I see more Mexican men married to black women in Texas, and Texas is one of the biggest states in the union, and it is not uncommon to see a Mexican-American man with a black wife. And it's more accepted by the blacks than if she had married a white man. Now, why that's so, I don't know. It's just a visual kind of, you know, thing that happened as I go in and I see, you know, what has happened. I have no research data as to why it occurs. Or the feasibility. I react to it a lot more comfortably than if I saw her with a white man. Now, don't ask me why. Maybe I feel it's because Mexicans are no better than we are, but I'm not going to say that because I don't know if that's really my feeling, okay? Any other questions? Yes, Leroy.
This is basically the same thing that I came to you about a year ago on. I'm having the same problem that I've always had. Working in a cancer screening program, trying to get pap smears and breast exams to supposedly high-risk populations of women, which includes Mexican Americans and blacks, or so NCI, National Cancer Center, have us believe. And yet every attempt to try and convince women to come in has been absolutely, you know, I mean, they're all negative reactions. You go out and say, well, it seems like, you know, women with these certain kinds of characteristics will not get it. They're like, you're just trying to, you know, get on our case again. You try to write up special literature aimed at blacks and you're patronizing. If you, you know, it seems like no matter what happens, it just basically don't, I haven't yet found a channel for getting information through that doesn't meet with, you know, immediate resistance. I think if I could get her, I might have a chance, but I don't get her so far.
Yeah.
What do you think about it? Got any thoughts?
Well, since we've talked, I've thought of a couple of other things, and I, you know, I think my husband is at the point where he wish I would sleep some nights and stop thinking. But I'm the kind of person that around 10 o'clock at night, the wheels start spinning, and I come up with all kinds of hypotheses and planning, and, you know, they don't always go anywhere, but at least I think. And I think that we have two problems to deal with, and that is the basic modesty of the black and the Mexican-American woman. I mean, you know, my husband does not want me in that room with that doctor, okay? And in a sense, if I may use the lower term or jargon of the black to explain that, is that my husband does not want anybody viewing his playground. And I think that with a Mexican-American woman, she's a very lady-like creature. You know, I mean, there's just some things that are very difficult for her to accept, and that's exposing her body to male scrutiny and examination. And the second thing that we have is the poverty factor. I may know that there is something wrong with me physically, but I cannot afford the time from my job, for my family to be sick. And if I come in and you find out that I'm sick, I'm going to have to go to the hospital or I'm going to have to see the doctor or my condition is going to cost money, which we don't have, and we don't have insurance to pay for. I think those are the two factors you're dealing with. Yeah.
But doesn't, you know, like you read about programs and you hear people talk about programs, especially in the women's movement, where women go into a program and wind up being sterilized. And this happens supposedly amongst minority groups rather than mainstream white families, white women. And in programs that are directed towards women that are they're just framing programs. And you know, and it comes from white medical status, you know, white doctors or white or the mainstream white medical tradition or whatever you want.
I think what you have just said, that the actions from a predominantly white medical system is only intensifying that basic sense of mistrust that blacks have had against whites for over 400 years. Yeah. Very good point. Any other questions?
Could you suggest?
Yes.
Could you mention a couple of articles you said you had written that might help us?
One article is called The Black Side of Healthcare, which was in the, where was it, Dr. Spencer? I never keep up with my public. I believe it's the Arizona Republic in August of 76. I'm now developing a chapter for a book for healthcare, and the title of that chapter is I Don't Have to Believe It Because You Say It So. I saw a question over here.
Yeah, is there a feeling of resentment or so on in terms of, you know, certain government programs and so on? Say there has to be so many minorities in this program. The fact that that is, you know, required, is there a resentment formed because of that, just because you're black and you're there?
You want my personal feeling about it, and
yeah.
You want an academic answer, I see. Okay. my personal feelings are is I ain't giving nobody something for nothing. I mean, if he wants it, he's going to have to work as hard as I did to get it. I mean, I'm no welfare agency. Okay, that says for me, if getting a certain segment of the black population a large increase of money meant that I had to paint a sign and walk down the street, I wouldn't do it. Okay? Because I think that it's time we stop giving ethnic people something for nothing. It takes away the pride, a sense of motivation. If we're going to talk about affirmative action programs, let's talk about programs that give these people an education or standard of living that they can be proud of. Do you have a sense that you're more proud of something when you sweated and labored to pay for it than if you had somebody give it to you? And I think that's what many affirmative action programs are turning into. And here again, it's because of the attitude of the over-liberal white and the guilty white. They bend the affirmative action guidelines in order to ease their conscience, and in the process, doing the minority person a great injustice. Man, it is rough to be sitting in an office and told that you have a $20,000 budget and you don't even know how to make up a budget. You know, it's even worse to be told that as a black, you will be responsible for this area or whatever and end up with a workers who work there knowing more about how to supervise the position than you do. You know, to me, that creates a sense of shame, low self-esteem. You know, how thick does your head have to be before you realize you're not qualified? Just because they needed five blacks, they took five blacks, and they took five Mexicans, and you weren't qualified. You see, you failed again. That's the only way it can be determined. And I think that many affirmative action programs are setting us up for failure. That's like somebody writing a guideline and saying, we've had white presidents of Pima Community College now for 7 years. It's time we have a black. And since Bess is a well-known black around here and the only one in administration, then she ought to be the president. To me, that's just about what affirmative action means to me at this point, because nobody has proven to me that they've taken a really good look at the guidelines for affirmative actions and attempted to help people develop themselves for the position before it's offered to them. Okay? Yes.
Your favorite Jesse Jackson program, then?
Yes. Operation Push. I think that is a program where a person develops self-pride in what you accomplish. Okay. You know, if you told me every year, you know, Bess, don't worry about it. I'll drive a Cadillac Seville in your driveway as quickly as it comes out every year, and I'll pay for the gas and the upkeep and everything. I don't care if I wreck it tomorrow. You're going to buy me another one next year. You see? That's pretty much what I'm getting at. Yes, Leah.
I think, you know, in terms of the question that this fellow put out, an aspect that I find myself running into a lot in terms of delivery of services, trying to make things available and accessible, is you get, you know, you get into these sort of quota games where you will have 7.4% of the people that you serve, such and such. And I think that anybody who's out there hustling, trying to survive, they're really well aware of this and almost resent it. So the more of a push you make to try to include, the more suspicious they become. Because, what's going on here? I don't want to be part of your quota. You know, you ain't put me on your statistical sheet.
That's
and
right.
And tend to even block out the services, even if they may or may not be good. I think it's even questioning whether the services is good or not, but just the idea that they got to have 7.3% black means I ain't even going near the place.
You know, in order to validate Leroy's point, please don't think that you're the only people who tell jokes about blacks. We tell jokes about blacks, and we laugh. We enjoy them. And the point that Leroy is making is that many times you say we have to have 7.3% quota in this particular building, you know, because we're receiving government funds and DHEW or DES says, you know, we must have. And so you,
you know, they reach out then for a person because of the color, not because of the qualifications to fill a certain position. So the joke goes like this. Two black guys meet up on the street. One said, hey, baby, what's happening? And I said, I just interviewed for a job. He said, yeah, what kind? Radio announcer. Do you see the thing that goes on there, you know? Okay? Our young men who are going in the Air Force and services on a volunteer basis. The joke was, this young black fellow was told they were going to put him in the paratroopers. Okay? They needed some blacks in the paratroopers. You know, and the blacks said, no, man, I don't want to do that because, I mean, I don't even jump out of my bed. I know I ain't going to jump out of no airplane. Okay? So anyway, they get the poor dude up there, and he's so afraid that the guy is saying, now, what you do is count to five. You see? And then you jump out of the plane, and you pull your ripcord, you know. And so the guy's there, you know, right at the door, and he said, Sarge, how high did you say I was supposed to count to? And the sergeant looked at him and said, you better count to one. You see? So it's just, you know, a matter of saying, you know, affirmative action programs have their purpose. And I think it's a good purpose. But I think that the fulfillment of the program needs something else to go with. I don't think it promotes racism so much as a...
Can you repeat the question, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. She asked that if I did not think putting an unqualified ethnic person in a position might not increase racism within the organization, that whites would resent this. And I don't think it's increasing racism. I think what we're seeing is a backlash response from the white. Because what's happening now is they're saying to us, you know, if you're white, I mean, you can't get a job. This happened to us long ago. You know, if you were black, step back. You know, you could not get a job. So we have seen a reversal situation take place now. And the white is saying the same thing that the black said many years ago. I have the wrong color. I can't get a job.
One question, just on a personal statement, to get another opinion. A long time ago, before I started my own business, and it was the reason why I did start my own business, I used to deal in heavy equipment, and I'd operate. And I worked for one company for about 6 years, and they laid me off, and they were going to another job, because I wasn't a minority, and they hired another guy in my place, who wasn't as good as I was, but laid me off. Which I don't mind now because I went out and started my own business and got into it and did a lot better. But I always felt a little bit of resentment to me that way, where I don't feel bad about giving somebody else a chance to do something, but I don't think taking somebody out of one position and replacing them in another is fair.
Well, I think it's even less fair to take you out of your position if you have been functioning at the level required of you to maintain that job. I think that it's bad to take you from that job and put somebody else in it just because they say they have a quota to meet. And I feel that, you know, over the 25 years or so that I've been in nursing and because of, you know, my stated experience and academic background and so forth, that I'm perfectly capable of being a director of the program. And I would feel as you did, if somebody came along and said, well, you know, you've been director long enough, we, you know, we've had a black long enough, now it's time we get a white, kind of thing. So you went through the same type of thing. But that's the kind of thing blacks have been going through with for a number of years.
Yeah, it's different when the shoe's on the other foot. Yeah.
Have you ever tried going to a black church on Sunday morning?
No, I haven't.
You'd feel awfully funny. But that's the same kind of situation. It's very difficult to find yourself in the minority position. And this is what is happening to employed whites now. You have become the minority in the job market. You see, you get last consideration in some
businesses, because as I say, their quota has to be 7% or 5% black.
One thing about that, we discussed it in the class that I'm teaching socialism, is that the thing about that is that many of those quotas and many of those jobs are sort of, quote unquote, are in the lower, I'm not sure if I explained it right, but they're not in the responsible position.
I understand what you're saying.
You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And more of the responsible position, guess who's going to be up there most of the time?
Okay, you preface that by saying most of the time, okay.
People are griping about the fact that maybe with this minority program, the whole thing, that, okay, people are taking my job, that kind of thing. The thing of it is that it's in the more than should be in a common kind of a job situation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go further up, you're going to find people not there.
Well, let's be honest with ourselves. If you look at the requirements or the job position, is that what it's called? Job description that is written for most jobs. How many minority people could fit that job description? You have to walk on water, man, to make most of them. Okay? Yes.
It seems to me that this is sort of a totally psychological issue. The thing of blacks competing with low income, lower middle income whites. When it's natural enough to feel hostile when you're competing for a job.
Mm-hmm.
But the point of fact is, the fault of the trade unions, the professional associations, and the corporations, who for so many years systematically practiced discriminatory hiring practices.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than get low to middle-income whites fighting plants for jobs. The simple issue is the private sector has not been able to provide jobs for Americans who want to work. So you either have public sector jobs or expand the helping professions. And I can understand why people feel a conflict nationally enough in competition.
But whose job
should not be against
whose job is it then to get the two races away from each other's throat now? I mean, who is perpetrating this type of belief and attitude that we now have against each other as white and black? Now, we can't resolve it because the guy who holds the job is the one who is initiating and perpetrating.
No, all I'm saying is that it's a game that's run on people.
Yeah, sure.
You have to divide off irrational options, and it need not be that way.
If you want to receive more monies in a city, I agree with you. All you have to do is write a big article that school kids are going to be bussed. And you start a riot. And it's easy to do that because you know the mentality and the emotional response level of people within that particular geographical area. And you say, well, now, if I want to get in the newspaper and I want to get some additional governmental funds, so forth, we'll put out this propaganda. Now we're going to start busing kids. The next thing you know, the people out on the street screaming, tearing up, breaking windows and attacking, whatever. And I think those are well-placed propagandical kinds of responses.
But why are there advanced and Chicago's were competing, but rather not the trade unions, the private sector, who have been systematically breaking constitutional law for 200 years.
Because it is easier to resent the black man that took your job than it is to file a suit against the company that just got you out of your job. Very simple. Any other questions? Well, I've enjoyed the time I've spent with you, and may I say something, and that is, please do not take my views as written laws. You are only talking to one aggressive, militant black woman. There are 50,000 other blacks in the United States and generally may have a different opinion, but I have just shared with you on the basis of my education and research the type of things that I found, and I thank you.
No, H.G. is fine.
Okay. He is a third-year resident at the
in the program of social medicine at Montefiore Hospital and Martin Luther King Health Center in the Bronx, New York, and he's an internal medicine trap in that program. We talk about or examine the validity and biases of screening procedures and the dangers and limitations of large-scale screening programs, and he will include some recommendations for future programs.
Thanks. I wasn't sure who the audience was going to be, and I guess that I was supposed to be prepared to go in two or three directions, but looking at the audience isn't going to help me anymore to know what direction to go in, so I think I'll just say what I have to say, what I had planned to say, and if anyone has any comments or questions at any time, please, just feel free to intervene, and also any comments are welcome, and when someone asks a question, anyone from the floor would like to answer it, will be fine too. I'm a resident in medicine. I'm not an expert in screening. I do have an interest in it. And so we'll kind of pursue these ideas together. At this festival here, there's a lot of fascinating things going on. There's a lot of topics about Navajo health healing, nutrition as a guideline to healthcare, philosophy and how one should lead one's life. The whole concept of an arcology is very, very interesting. So there's a lot of non-traditional things being talked about here, as well as some things that are a little bit indirect, which are a celebration of life and therefore indirectly a celebration of health, like dance, arts, building, friendship, cooperation. All those things really kind of gel to give an atmosphere here of some really high energy, fun things going on. Then we talk about the topic of medical screening, which seems a bit traditional, and in fact, the name is pretty unexciting and can be looked at by some people as relatively uninteresting, maybe unstimulating. But in fact, medical screening is a relatively popular topic in that it's gotten a lot of literature written about it, a lot of emphasis in the last few years, particularly since World War II. And beyond this, there's a lot of individuals in this country who are subjected to this, either willingly or unwillingly, to some types of screening. For example, I think, although I haven't had a chance to get down there today, that there's some screening going on down below. I'm not sure what it is. I'll try to check it out later. So screening really touches a lot of our lives. It's a topic that's written about by health educators, by administrators, by people in hospitals, as well as rural physicians and patient and regular private physicians in the inner city and in the suburbs. So it's a pretty pervasive topic. So what is medical screening? Well, medical screening is the detection of disease in its asymptomatic state. When you try to detect the disease at a point where therapy can have a positive intervention. In other words, someone's asymptomatic, there's something wrong with them, you detect it by some sort of test. And you assume that test you're going to detect, that you're going to use, is going to find something that can be taken care of and corrected, whereas they would go on to develop symptoms later and supposedly have a shorter lifespan by your not intervening. So ideally, you intervene, you find something wrong, and you do something about it. Now, this is in contrast to making a diagnosis and curing someone. For example, when someone comes to the doctor and says they have a pain in their side, you're going to do a lot different kinds of tests. Then it's up to you to find out if you're a doctor or a nurse or a physician extender or a nurse practitioner or a mother or a friend. It's up to you to find out what's going on with the pain in the side. And then you do tests in a much different way. You're trying to find something wrong with someone who has a complaint. But someone who comes in and is feeling fine or comes to a festival like this and has their blood pressure taken, then the implications are much greater. You are telling them that you are going to subject them to something that may be beneficial to them when they're feeling fine, when they're doing well, and they may or may not understand what does this mean? Why should I subject myself to such tests? So the relationship of screening then, sometimes confusingly, relates pretty well to prevention. And when we talk about preventive medicine, we talk about primary prevention, secondary prevention, and tertiary prevention. Just a quick review for probably everyone who's aware of those. Primary prevention means you are intervening in such a way to actually deter the onset of a disease. You immunize someone against tetanus, you immunize someone against smallpox. They've never had tetanus, they've never had smallpox. You give them the immunization with the hope of protecting them against a disease. Secondary prevention is what we were just talking about, and that's what we screen for, intervention in asymptomatic individuals. And tertiary prevention means preventing the complications of a disease that already took place. For example, someone has a stroke. Well, if someone has a stroke and you let them lie in bed, 1 or 2 days they'll have contractions of the muscles, they'll have bed sores. So good nursing care and good rehabilitation care obviously cannot change the fact that someone's had a stroke, but in fact can prevent a lot of the complications, which are severely disabling, that take place after disease has occurred. So screening then touches among many, many issues. And it has to do with ethical, economic, political, as well as medical issues. We talked about the ethical a little bit, the right to intervene in someone's life or to make someone feel that there should be a reason to intervene when they were feeling fine as it is. Just the suggestion that there may be something wrong could have a deleterious effect on someone. Well, maybe I am sick, when someone thought before they weren't sick at all. Then there's the economic, the old dollars and cents about where to put money, how to intervene. Should we spend money on research into basic science, or should we put money into screening large populations to try to find and detect diseases that we already know how to cure? And then there's the political question as well. One of the things most interesting in the political question is what to screen for. I think it's a political question. For example, if you take black children who live in the South Bronx where I work, from age 5 to 9, the 10-year mortality, in other words, the things that they're most likely to die from age 5 to 15, if in fact they would die, would be first motor vehicle accidents, second drowning, third fire, and fourth homicide. None of those have to do anything with doctors or nurses or hospitals or medical care as we know it. Those are all social issues. And so one has to ask himself, well, is it the place of any of us in the medical profession or not to intervene there? And for example, prevention there would be wearing seat belts, teaching people how to swim, and much more importantly than that, obviously, would be correcting the ills of society, which allows people to have this kind of housing, live in these kind of areas, etc. So that is a political issue. The other thing that you could talk about is screening as a right versus a privilege, which is also a political issue, which can be debated by the right and the left. And you must ask, too, whether or not the competitive fee-for-service type of system that works today really cares about prevention and intervention on a scale that would, in fact, possibly deter them from, in the long run, getting as much and maintaining their superiority in delivering medical care by themselves. The political issue also might be looked at, just to skip ahead, by take the issue of smoking. Smoking is a disease we can detect for easily. We can ask someone, do you smoke? Usually most people won't lie, they'll say yes or no, I smoke. And it doesn't cost anything to ask the question, and it doesn't cost anything to tell them to stop. Now, one might think, well, and most people I think would take the vantage point that if a friend or a doctor or a nurse says smoking is bad for you, it causes lung cancer, it's associated with cardiovascular disease, it's associated with carcinoma of the bladder, you give them the facts, and then if they choose not to smoke, then in fact they're making a wise choice, and if they choose to continue to smoke, then it's their responsibility and their fault. I think that's only partially true, because a lot of the issues around this, around smoking, around nutrition, have to do with what's available. If cigarettes are available everywhere you turn, in a gas station, in the movie theater, even in hospital corridors when you're visiting patients, and if candy bars instead of celery and carrots, Coke instead of orange juice is available in the vending machines, it's not totally your fault that you eat the candy bars and that you smoke cigarettes. There's a lot of economic forces at work as well to make you want to smoke, to make you want to eat candy bars, not just to want to by advertising, but also by the availability. So yes, it's an individual. I think it is somewhat an individual choice. There's no question about that. You can quit smoking if you want. But all of us know it would be a lot easier to quit smoking if those around us didn't smoke and if there weren't any cigarettes to buy. Now, obviously, the tobacco industry in this country is probably not going to allow this kind of thing to happen. So we can all bang our heads against the wall and say how bad smoking is and do study after study after study, and it really hasn't affected any group that I know of except doctors, who have definitely are smoking less now than 10 years ago. But I would guess that soon that's going to start to rise again. That's just a guess. The The other thing that screening brings up, again, and so far I've talked about disease, asymptomatic disease, preventing disease, is the whole health versus disease orientation. And I think that this seminar really, really focuses on this clearly. That is that medical professionals and medical people have always looked upon the quote health system by a medical model of disease, which means that we're all sick until we're proven not sick. Now notice I didn't say until we're proven well, because that's a concept that's a little bit foreign as a rule to the medical profession. For example, probably a lot of you have been in hospitals either as patients or you work there, and when you do a history and physical examination, the way that you write it up in the chart is very interesting. You write up in the chart when you're asking a patient something, the patient denies chest pain, denies fever, denies chills. Then when you do the physical examination, no masses felt, no murmur heard. It's totally, totally inappropriate to write in the chart, the heart sounds great, the patient's belly feels wonderful. That's medical malpractice. That's totally foreign to our way of thinking. Yet in fact, at the end of a physical exam, I think what would be nice to do would be to look at someone and say, you know, that's terrific, your body is great, you know, as far as I can tell. So the whole medicalization of society and looking at a patient as sick rather than inherently well is also one of the major problems with the medical profession, and also this relates to screening. We're going to find something that's wrong with you. Now I'm going to be giving a lot of double messages because in fact there probably are some things that may be wrong with some people that are good to look for, and that's one of the things I want to look at. But I think inherently that most people probably are healthy. Now, the other thing that this brings up then about the disease model is that today there's a lot of emphasis on health promotion and health attributes. I think there's some groups in Colorado, some groups in California, where they actually, unlike this physical and history exam I was just talking about, actually give you a list of health attributes, and when you fill out a questionnaire or go through some sort of a week program, you come out, you know, with a whole list showing how healthy you are, rather than how diseased or how sick you potentially are. So, as you can see, screening is kind of a broad topic. I can't discuss all the aspects of it, nor would I probably be able to discuss all the aspects. So I'm just going to touch upon a limited number of topics and try to illustrate some points with the rest of the talk. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the principles and validations of screening tests. I want to talk about some myths about screening, its abuses, its large areas of uncertainties, the commercialization of screening, and I want to talk about one or two specific diseases and how they relate to screening. And then we'll continue to do some sort of a summary. Now, at this point, I just want to proceed with kind of a heavy quote here, which is kind of sobering and makes any doctor or nurse think that they're doing a tremendously difficult task. Yet I think this points out especially the ethical points of screening. This is a quote by McEwen, and it reads as follows. When the patient seeks medical advice, the doctor's ethical position is relatively simple. He attempts to do his best with the knowledge and resources available to him. He cannot be fairly criticized when the state of medical knowledge does not enable him to treat effectively or even to diagnose accurately. The position is quite different in screening, when a doctor or a public authority takes the initiative in investigating the possibility of illness or disability in people who have not reported signs or symptoms. There is then a presumptive undertaking, not merely that abnormality will be identified if it is present, but that those affected will derive benefit from subsequent treatment or care. This commitment is at least implicit, and except for research or the protection of public health, no one should be expected to submit to the inconvenience of investigation or the anxieties of case finding without the prospect of medical benefit. All right, essentially what they're saying there is that if you're going to go in and intervene in someone's life, then you better have a good reason to do it, and you better have a test that's proven that it can work, and you better be ready to follow up the patient as well. So, from there, let's go on a second to look in at a few of these principles here and how we do screening, but I want to talk about six criteria that a screening test, any sort of a test should meet in order to be a valid screening test. These have been developed and accepted by WHO, by various groups across the country, as criteria which should be met before a test can be considered valid. The first would be that the disease screened for must have a significant effect on the quality and quantity of life. In other words, you want to screen for something not necessarily a cold, which is going to go away by itself, but something like maybe certain cancers, which in fact, if you detect, you may be able to do something about. You also have to have an acceptable method of therapy, and this therapy must be available. Now, that availability issue, of course, is something that I'm sure a lot of people in this room are aware of. It's one thing to have the therapy. It's another thing some people may not be able to afford it. So this implies that there has to be diagnostic confirmation of any abnormal test, and there has to be some sort of follow-up. Third is that a disease must have an asymptomatic period during which detection of the disease can alter significantly the outcome of the disease if an intervention is made. This implies, in other words, that when you detect a disease, you can do something about it, and you can do something differently from if that disease were allowed to proceed to symptoms, and then you did, and then you made the diagnosis. The next one would be that you have to have suitable tests which are safe, which are acceptable to the patients, which are valid, and must be available at a reasonable cost to detect the condition. Again, it doesn't make much sense to have some super complicated, super expensive screening test which can detect something if it means sticking catheters into people's hearts and into their bladders so you can detect something. It has to be acceptable, it has to be easily accessible, and it has to be something that doesn't cost too much money, at least in this day and age. So it has to be something that the long-term beneficial effects have to outweigh the long-term detrimental effects, which then becomes obvious. Another thing is that, just as a point here, you can talk about screening individuals for the individual's case, or you can talk about screening individuals for the benefit of the society. For example, if it's just any of us who go in to have some sort of screening test, what we're trying to do is find something that may be wrong with us so we can do something about. On the other hand, society makes a choice, for example, that airplane pilots or steel crane operators get screened, and that they have to subject themselves to physical examinations whether they want to or not, because if they had a seizure or if they had a heart attack, etc., that they would be endangering everyone on the airplane, everyone working on the construction site, etc. So there does seem to be some justification, if screening works, for that. Although, interestingly enough, I think airplane pilots would argue that point by saying when they're in the cockpit of an airplane, there's two other people just as qualified as they are to take over the airplane if that fails, if they had a heart attack or a seizure. So in fact, even that can be argued. The other perspective is one to get at this point in time is about what most people in this country seem to want and seem to demand. If you're talking about a nurse practitioner or a health extender or a doctor who goes into a small town or even into a city, you can talk about preventive medicine and education and screening, and they say, yeah, that's great, doc, you know, that sounds good. But what they want, you know, what they want is someone to come in there and fix their broken arm, take care of their sore throat, take care of their sick child at night. And that's very understandable, because people, as a rule, don't consider themselves sick until they're told that there's screening projects which may be able to find something, until they're educated. And sometimes, as I say, with negative aspects, that they're educated that there may be something wrong with them. They feel fine, and what they want out of someone in a medical profession is someone who's going to take care of them when they don't feel well. Essentially, that's what they want. Hey, doc, my arm's broken. Fix it. I got to go back. I got other things to do. And that's perfectly understandable. So I just want to get on to some concepts of sensitivity and specificity and prevalence when we talk about screening tests. And I hope this isn't too complicated. And if it's, I'll try to go through it relatively quickly, and I don't know if it'll be interesting or not. I'll just take a sample and try to go through it quickly. The reason I'm showing it is because these, which are relatively important concepts, are not known by a lot of people. And if some of you are probably into screening and doing things, it may be interesting to look at it. You may want to comment on this. So, just get the concept first of sensitivity of the test. Okay, so we're talking about a screening test now. Sensitivity of a test is the ability of the test to be positive when the person has the disease. In other words, you want to get a test, it will test for as many people who have the disease and try to eliminate those who don't. So it is, it's the number of diseased persons with a positive test out of all the diseased persons tested. So in other words, if 100 people have tuberculosis, you do a PPD or some other test, and 98 of those have the test, then it'll be, times 100, it'll be 98% sensitivity. There'll only be two tested who didn't have it. whereas the specificity is the ability of a test to be negative when a person doesn't have the disease. In other words, if you don't have TB and you put on a PPD, you want yours to be negative. In other words, you want to be free, you want the test to be negative when you don't have the disease. So it's the non-diseased persons with a negative test, in other words, all those who don't have TB and test negative, over all of the non-diseased patients tested, because there'll be some patients with TB who have a negative PPD. Okay, is that clear? Most people. All right.
And there'll be some positive who don't have the disease too.
Right. That's what this is. Some of them will be positive who don't have the disease. That's a false positive. Right. So this kind of summarizes that. If this is the disease and you have a screening result for any given test, some people will screen that they have the disease, they'll screen positive. C would be people who have the disease but don't screen positive. Okay? In other words, that would be someone who is a false negative. Whereas here, someone who doesn't have the disease screens positive for the disease. Okay? And someone here who doesn't have the disease screens that they don't have the disease. So these two are fine. These are the people with the disease who screen positive. These are the people without the disease who screen negative. Okay? And so here, the sensitivity of the test, again, which we just went over, is the people who screen positive over all those with the disease times 100. And the specificity is the people without the disease over all the people who screen negative. Right, so that's sensitivity and specificity. Then that'd be nice if every test were like that, but of course there's always the gray zone, kind of the idea of overlapping distributions. This is the problem with a lot of tests. Not only is it difficult to implement a screening program, but you have to know what you're going to call a disease and what you're going to call non-disease, and we don't know that. A lot of this is kind of arbitrary. And again, I hate to keep talking in disease terms, but that's what we're talking about when we're talking about screening. So, for example, if you take glaucoma, these would be people without glaucoma, these would be people with glaucoma, and these would be people both with and without glaucoma. If you measure the intraocular pressure, which is the pressure here in the anterior chamber of the eye, what you find is that if you use 22 as a cutoff, if you use 26 as a cutoff point, it'll be a very specific test, but not a sensitive test. It'll be specific because everybody who doesn't have the disease, all of this group, will screen negative. But there's a whole group of people here who have the disease who won't screen positive. Everybody see that? So, and then if we moved it back though to 22 and made 22 the cutoff, then this whole area here would be included, and it would be a 100% sensitive test because everybody with glaucoma would test positively. But there would be a lot of people who didn't have glaucoma who would also test positively, so it wouldn't be a very specific test. So you trade sensitivity and specificity. So then how do you predict a value of a test? Well, one of the important things in predicting a value of a test is it's something we call predictive value positive and predictive value negative. Let's just take an example of that. Say you have a test that's 95% sensitive and 95% specific, which seems pretty good. I mean, you know, it seems 95%, 95%, that seems fine. And the prevalence of the disease, that is how much disease there is in the population, is 2%. Say you have a population of 10,000. Well, out of 10,000, you know, 2% of 10,000 is 200. So 200 people will be diseased, will have the disease, whatever it is. And the sensitivity, therefore, is 95%. So 190 people will test positive for that, right? And that leaves 10 who will test negative, okay? That leaves, if there's 200 who have the disease, there's 9,800 who don't. And the specificity would be 9,310 people who test negatively, but look at 490 people who don't have the disease test positively. That's a lot of people. And in a screening test, what you have to do then, you're obligated to test all these people diagnostically now, to follow them up because they've had a positive test, and to make sure, in fact, that they are false positive. Is everybody, is that clear to everyone?
Why don't we test out all the time? Testing techniques not accurate enough, or is it just because of the individual's reaction to it?
Well, it's because of individual variation. Most tests are done within confidence limits, you know, 95% confidence limits, 2 standard deviations from the norm, but there's a lot of normal people who lie outside those limits. And that's what that overlapping zone is, and that's what this represents. And the other thing is, yes, you're absolutely right. The test is not necessarily, one test isn't going to necessarily show, nor do maybe 2 or 3 or 4, that someone has a disease.
Another issue, I think, is during the period of time from the learner that you have a positive screening test result until you get the diagnostic test that indicates that you have the disease, is very anxiety-producing for many people.
That's a very good point.
I particularly experienced that with elderly glaucoma patients who have been at a fair and shopping center and have had a test and it's been positive, and then by the time they got to the eye doctor, they had high blood pressure from the anxiety issues.
That's absolutely true. Isn't it? And I'm sure that others of you have had that experience, and that's a very good point. And one of the real negative aspects of testing is the fear, anxiety can provoke in someone if they're told they're sick when they may in fact not be at all. And glaucoma is an excellent example of this because there's no good screening test for glaucoma at all. And it's an especially bad test to screen for. So that's a very good point. Thanks for bringing it up. So predictive value of the test, then, getting back to this, is look at, if you've got 190 who have the disease and test positive, this is the number who have the disease, over all the people who tested positive for the disease, you have a predictive value with 95% sensitivity, 95% specificity, of only 27.9% that test is going to be a valid test for screening. Because your prevalence is 2%. And most chronic diseases in this country have a low prevalence, 1 to 2%. So even with this, so what this illustrates is that with a low prevalence and even a high sensitivity and specificity, you're going to have a very low predictive value positive. Okay. Just to illustrate this with an example. You take diabetes. You screen 10,000 people, and the prevalence of diabetes is, say, it's 1.5%. So again, there's 150 who have the disease. And now let's take 2 different screening levels, which again, this is a bad example, because taking a blood sugar level of 180 or 150 or 130 is not valid for diabetes, but it has been done for years, and it's still done by a lot of places. So let's just say that the cutoff is 180. The sensitivity of the test is 22.9%, specificity is 99.8%. What you come out with here is that if you test people, 34 out of these out of the people with the disease will test positive, okay? 116 will test negative out of that test. So what you get is you get a predictive value positive of the positives plus the false positives, which is 63%. Now, if you change the screening level to 130, now the sensitivity goes up, which makes sense, right? Because now we're moving it back more, so we're going to get more people who have diabetes by lowering the blood sugar level here. Specificity is 99%. And here, what you have is, you pick up more people, obviously, you get a more sensitive test. But you also pick up more people who don't have diabetes in that range. In other words, who have a blood sugar between 130 and 180, they don't have diabetes at all. But now they're testing positive, and it's up to you to prove that they don't have it, so here goes more work, more expense, more diagnostic intervention. Yeah?
What does it mean to have diabetes?
Well, I don't know if we want to go into that.
No, but I mean, I just walked in here, but you're saying that this person has it and this one doesn't have it.
I tried to preface what I said by exactly that this is not a good indication of what diabetes is, what the blood sugar level is. Your point's well taken. I don't particularly want to get into what it is to have diabetes, but this
this is just an example of a bad test anyway, even without defining what diabetes is, because what this shows is that this is not a good test at all at 130, 180, or 120. What really shows when someone has diabetes, I suppose, if you're talking about preclinical diabetes, is a glucose tolerance test, which we don't do very often, or when someone becomes symptomatic, then we know they have diabetes. We can prove it by blood sugar. Right. For adult onset diabetes. Right. Okay. So what you can see here is, again, as the one of the points you want to make of this is that as the prevalence of a disease goes up, in other words, in the population, the predictive value of the test goes up. So what that means is that it makes sense, rather than screening a whole general mass population, to screen selected populations. So there's two principles, at least, to come out of this. As the prevalence goes up and the sensitivity and specificity of a test stay the same, your predictive value positive will go up. In other words, the higher the prevalence, the more chance you'll have that you'll be catching people with the disease. Okay? And that's good. The other thing is that you want to screen a selective population. Now, you don't want to just go out, for example, where I work in the South Bronx, it makes sense to screen for TB because there's still tuberculosis there. It makes sense to screen for ovine parasites. In other words, there's a lot of people who've come from Puerto Rico within the last 5 years where there's still a lot of parasitic conditions. It wouldn't make sense, I don't think, in Cincinnati to screen everyone for ONP, or in other areas of New York City to screen for ovine parasites. So when you talk about screening selective populations, then your prevalence of the disease is higher, so you have a much better chance of good screening tests and it making sense. People will agree with that, go along with that? Okay, and that's all that this is demonstrating. I'm going to skip this one. This is just an example here of some diseases. You can look at that for a minute, and their sensitivity and specificity by test while I go find out where I am here. Okay. Okay. Now, one of the specific things I want to talk about, besides the principles here, was some of the myths in screening. And it seems to me one thing that's been written about, talked about a lot, is the concept of the annual physical examination, periodic health exam, the annual checkup. Doc, I had a checkup last year, I need another checkup this year. Or you read in the paper, it's time for a checkup. You read in Reader's Digest, you ought to do this, you ought to ask your doctor that, or you ought to go to this medical facility or that because it's time for a checkup. Well, this seemed to originate about 1860 with a British doctor by the name of Dobell, who at a conference gave a lecture where he really kind of instituted the idea of the necessity of a physical examination, of an annual physical examination. And it's just kind of interesting to hear what he said. He said, "I'm perfectly convinced from my own observation and experience and practice that patients never think of consulting their doctors till these conditions of impaired general health have advanced far enough to have been developed into some form of disease. That thousands and thousands of people believing themselves to be in health are nevertheless undergoing these early occult and evasive stages of defect in the physiologic state. And that such persons may be considered to be in health, not only by themselves, but by anyone accustomed to associate with them, even though it may be a physician, and that even if they submit to a medical exam as ordinarily conducted, they may be declared to be in good health. I wish then to propose, as the only means by which to reach the evil and to obtain the good, that there should be instituted as a custom a system of periodic examination to which all persons should submit themselves and to which they should submit their children." All right. Makes a lot of sense, probably in 1860 or 1861. Go ahead, Leon.
Well, Jim, I was going to ask you, how do you feel today about some of the principles that are expressed
there? Right. Well, that's one of the things I want to get to, and I think that what I want to try to show is that, in fact, an annual checkup
an annual examination is not necessary. It has not been shown to do more good than harm, and in fact it's probably a waste of time and effort for anyone to just go in on a yearly basis simply for the matter of having a physical examination, chest x-ray, EKG, bloods done. It's been shown time and time again that a yearly chest x-ray, a yearly electrocardiogram, a yearly physical examination is not worth the time and effort. I will try to show some of the things that may be worth the time, but that's how I feel. To examine someone's ears and to examine their throat and to listen to their lungs once a year is really, in my opinion, a waste of time. That's, again, now, I'm not saying if someone has a complaint, but if we're talking about the person who comes in for their yearly checkup, feeling fine, what are you going to do? Okay. Now, the reason that this quote by Dobell falls hard is because this doctor-patient relationship and the yearly physical exam is kind of a time-honored tradition for at least 100 years. It's been reinforced by the AMA in this country for a number of years, since about 1900, by an ophthalmologist named Gould gave a similar kind of speech. And it's never been studied. It's just something we've accepted and gone along with. Now, there are social pressures other than medical and MD pressures to promote this periodic health examination. For example, some governments or the government may want to do this in a positive way to look into reducing costs in the long run. Industry may want to do it to have this periodic exam to prevent, to give their employees fringe benefits, to have something to market, to try new kinds of methods. And then, of course, private entrepreneurs who are interested in making money would like as many new screening tests, machines, gadgets, etc., as possible to be on the market so that we can all have a new kind of screening test to show what's wrong with us. And I want to emphasize that a lot of these really are sold and marketed without any proven experience whatsoever. And the point that was made earlier about the anxiety and the fear is multiplied when these kind of tests are allowed to be on the market. Let me just allude to some kinds of studies that have been done about periodic health examinations. There was a cooperative research project which involved 8 executive health clinic studies. In other words, these were all, you know, upper middle class businessmen, executives who had regular periodic examinations. And they compared, over a 15-year period, they compared the morbidity and mortality of these people with an unscreened population, and there was essentially no significant difference. There was another study done by Kaiser Permanente, which you probably all heard of as a big group out in California. They began in 1964 with a very good controlled population. In other words, they had a group of people who they screened and a group of people who they didn't screen. And as of about a year or two ago at least, that study up till then showed that the only difference was in a group of men from age 45 to 59, there was a decrease in absenteeism from work and also a decrease in disability claims of statistical significance, but very, very small percentage, like 1 or 2%. And this was in one age group, and that's all that they found by doing this periodic health examination. So the figures there weren't very, very impressive. Then there was a commission on chronic illness, which was a retrospective study, which studied, done in the 1950s, which compared screened and unscreened mortality rates among some middle-class executives again. And here the conclusion was that they couldn't tell by screening or unscreening whether there was an effect. Now, there was another study done in pediatrics by a man named Anderson in the early 1960s, where he did routine physical examinations on 6,500. He compiled a group, 6,500 infants under the year of 1 year of age. And there were 130 out of those that something clinically significant was detected in. 130 out of 668. There was also a study done by someone named Shore, which is something very interesting. He took 192. Again, these were high-power executives who get periodic physical examinations, both by their own request and by their company's request. And what he found was, and these were men aged 40 to 59 who had died. And they had all had recent examinations before they died. I don't know the exact time, but 60% of the people died of diseases totally unknown to them or that were not detected on the examination before they died. Now, this isn't an indictment, really, of an examination, but it shows you people, you've all heard, and it happens all the time, people come out of a physical examination feeling good, doctor says everything's fine or that you're not sick, and then they drop dead the next day of a heart attack. Maybe they had a perfectly normal electrocardiogram, they were going around. So you can't really detect
them.
Well, even if they did, that may still not have detected
them. Oh, of course, but that's a big difference between
between a resting electrocardiogram. I agree. But the point is that you can't detect a lot of things before these things happen. There's also an interesting concept by someone who did a study which had never been done until 1966, or only one of it had been done, something he called early sickness consultation. It was his premise that all this screening was worthless. This man's name was Siegel, and he thought that by coming to the doctor, having a good doctor-patient relationship or nurse-patient relationship or some sort of medical worker relationship with a patient, that when you got sick or felt you were sick, if you went to the doctor right away and you had very active, intensive investigations, that this was just as good as any sort of periodic screening. And I think he's probably right for a physical examination, but he may be wrong for some of the diseases that we can detect. But it was an interesting concept and something that hadn't been looked at much before that, was that the minute you're sick, you go to the doctor as opposed to having intervention in a preventive screening type of manner. Of course, we all know that very, very few people run to the doctor the minute they start to cough or the minute they don't feel well. And I think all we'd be doing with that would be producing a society of hypochondriacs to encourage that kind of thing. So even though it's an interesting concept, I don't advocate it, and I doubt anyone would. There's also kind of an amusing aspect of this in our very mobile society, again, which Arcasani is trying to do away with by letting us all go by foot. It's an interesting concept to think of the morbidity and the mortality of people who get in an automobile accident or hit going across the street on their way to have their periodic health examination. This would probably be an hours lost and death rate. Probably it may be higher than the things picked up at the exam. And we know how many people drive 40 or 45 minutes to see their doctor. Most of automobile accidents occur within 20 miles of the home. So probably you got a better chance of getting killed on your way to the exam than you do on having something picked up at the exam. That's not a study. That's just a speculation. On the other hand, there are, getting back to the harmful effects which were done, there are corporations which use stringent guidelines about what their executives can or cannot do. For example, there was one corporation that had a cutoff point of a certain triglyceride level and certain cholesterol level in the blood. And people in these corporations were actually prevented from advancing in their positions if they had a certain blood level greater than the accepted norm. Now, this is preposterous in the sense that not only have cholesterol and triglycerides not been proven to be causative of any disease, but we know from individual variation that just using one test like this as an individual variant is totally unfair. So we can see that sometimes people have gone to extremes in keeping people from being promoted on the job or getting a certain job. And I've seen this before, people who misread electrocardiograms, people who do tests incorrectly, etc. It can be very harmful to any given individual. And obviously, if you apply that and magnify that, it can be very harmful to the society, too. It's kind of interesting to read about someone who's defiant. This was a British doctor who was at a conference when people were talking about physical examinations. And he said, he was apparently a prominent British physician as well. He said, "I have never had a medical checkup, and I have no intention of having one, nor have my relatives, nor any of my medical friends. Why should we inflict on the long-suffering public what we're not prepared to endure ourselves?" I would say that probably most MDs do not get a periodic physical examination. I would guess that their wives or husbands don't either, nor do their families. And I think this is a particularly apt quote when it comes to that. So the point is, which you asked me a little bit earlier, Leanne, was what do I think? Well, I don't think that there's much evidence to show that a periodic health examination, given the annual checkup or every 6 months, does much good. And it potentially can do harm, although it hasn't been shown that it does harm either. Anybody want to comment on that? Sure.
Yeah,
It's one of those time-honored, die-hard things, a doctor-patient relationship of the society educated to think that they need a physical checkup, and of the medical profession for years recommending that this was the route to go. You need a physical examination. And I think it's something that's been looked at really for the first time in the last 3 or 4 years to show. I mean, the New York Times, which is really the New York Times Journal of Medicine, because I learn a lot of my medicine out of the New York Times. I read it there before anywhere else. It's an excellent medical paper. It has been looking at this, has been criticizing it too. But yeah, I think that's, I think it's just a time-honored tradition, one of these things that it's been expected to be done and you do it. And I don't think most of the medical profession today believes that it still shouldn't be done. I still think they're in favor of it. Okay, let me just move on to hypertension, which is really a huge topic which everyone is well acquainted with. And I believe is one of the areas where screening can have a positive effect. There have been a number of studies by the Veterans Administration, by Framingham study, et cetera, which show that people with hypertension definitely have a higher morbidity and mortality from cardiovascular disease, from strokes, from congestive heart failure, from coronary disease, from heart attacks. And they also have a higher incidence of renal, of kidney disease and eye problems. Yet something as simple as this, supposedly the concept of screening for hypertension, what are you really asking someone to subject themselves to? First of all, look at all the things that can go wrong. You have to properly take the blood pressure. You have to explain to someone that even though they feel well, they may have abnormal blood pressure. What that means, you have to explain it properly in terms that sometimes are difficult for us to understand. You have to tell someone we don't know what causes high blood pressure. And then the absurdity of it all is you have to tell them that if you have high blood pressure, if we're correct in the way we take it and the way we do it, that you probably have to be on therapy, which means medication for life.
Who says you have to say that?
I don't say we have to say that. I say that's what's recommended to say. I disagree with that, but that's what the recommendations are now. If you have hypertension, it's detected, there's significant morbidity and mortality, so what do? You treat it. How do you treat it? How does the medical profession treat everything? With pills. We give them pills. If one pill doesn't work, we give them two. Two doesn't work, we give them three. And there's a lot of hypertensives walking around who take four kinds of medication. Maybe they take 10 and 12 pills a day. I mean, that's a lot to ask of someone, especially when they're feeling fine when they come to you and the pills make them tired. They make them urinate all night, and they make them impotent.
So don't give them pills.
No. Don't give them pills. I mean, let's talk about that. What do you think causes hypertension, essential hypertension?
The fact that it's called essential answers the question.
What,
you have to have,
no. Right. The cause is not known. But we can speculate what the cause is, and there's all sorts of studies and research being done on this. And it's coming more and more to be obvious to some people that the cause of it is it's caused by the society and the stresses in the society, the competitiveness, the stresses that people are under, that it's not cultural, that black people don't get hypertension more because they're prone to hypertension, but because they're more prone possibly to living in conditions which are higher stress conditions. Now that's not accepted, but there's a lot of people who believe it, and I happen to be one of them who thinks that that's an important thing. Yeah. That's a good point. You know, you go to the doctor and you want medicine. But you don't usually go wanting medicine for life. And that's a hard thing for people to take. But that's a hard concept. But I think you're absolutely right. It's a pill-oriented society. And again, getting back to what we were saying earlier, that isn't just coming from our heads. I mean, there's a whole enormous industry, the pharmaceutical industry, which profits from that kind of thought process. Yeah?
We heard from a physician speak yesterday that the test that you may have referred to done by the VA was done on a group of men who were heavy smokers, heavy drinkers, and were in a rather narrow age category of being World War II veterans, and were all male. I'm not sure if that is the test that you are referring to. It was a large test, but it was a rather specific group.
Right. In that group of people, it showed, it definitely showed, I can't remember the exact makeup of the group, but it showed in that group, other risk factors were supposedly controlled for, as I recall, but there was a significant difference. The Framingham study had a much larger group and showed the same results. And other studies since then have validated the fact that treating hypertension is in fact efficacious, treating it by our standard methods. You know, there are a lot of people, there are other people working, and probably people here who are into this about biofeedback, relaxation, etc. And there's a big difference in taking someone's blood pressure at home and in the office, or in a clinic, or in a hospital. People, when they are often more anxious, obviously, and uptight, when they're having some sort of medical intervention, as opposed to when they're home and relaxed. Yeah.
It seems like a lot of things you're saying are not against the AMA, but feel like
I'm not sure what the percentage is.
I didn't know what the
percentage is. That's right.
So, like, you can see against it openly, and there's no.
Right. Right. I have, in my way of thinking, I just have very little room for the AMA. I think that they're a very conservative group who are mostly, they're more concerned than they used to be, but I think they're more concerned with preserving the rights and privileges of the physician than they are with promoting the health of the nation. Now, there are some good people in the AMA. There's some people who always believe about working within the system. But I think that they are, still are in the vast, significant minority of the AMA. The AMA is not a progressive, health-oriented organization. It's one there to preserve the rights and privileges of the physician, I think. Yeah.
I'm just interested, maybe you can go with this. You said you were a resident in social medicine?
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could define that, and also what your alternative is to the pill patients, since you think it's a common.
Yeah, good. Again, the residency program is kind of a unique program. It's training, clinical training, but also training in, it emphasizes outpatient medicine, and it also emphasizes public health or social medicine issues. But it's like other training programs in that you do inpatient medicine also. So in 3 years you get trained and you're board eligible, which means you can take your boards in internal medicine, just like anyone in another program, but it tries to emphasize other aspects of medicine as well, some of the non-clinical issues and some of the outpatient and also some of the social issues, which we just don't hear about in medical school, and you hear less about when you're an intern or a resident, and even less about when you're an MD in private practice. So this program that I'm in tries, at least makes an attempt to do that. The program's in the Bronx in New York City. It's associated with Montefiore Hospital. And it's got three tracks in it. It has internal medicine, pediatrics, and family practice. So there are residents within each track, but they're all in the program called social medicine. I don't want to get into a discussion on it because there's advantages and disadvantages, but it is the only program like that that I know of that exists in the country. And it does have people from all over in the program, all over the country. It's an interesting group of people, if not confused about priorities and goals, etc. Anything else? Okay, so what about, you know, some just briefly, some other myths that I talked about earlier. Well, some of the myths are that by doing blood tests, a lot of blood tests, we can detect all sorts of things wrong with people. Actually, what we do by doing blood tests are magnify the chance that someone will have an abnormal test the more tests we do. And a lot of you probably know that, again, this has to do with the 95% confidence limit and the standard deviations. If you do 15 tests, blood tests on someone, in other words, you draw a tube of blood, and in most hospitals, they do 18 examinations, calcium, potassium, sodium, all the things. Your chances of having, quote, an abnormal test when they do that many tests in a healthy individual is 54%. So one out of two people is going to be called sick when they're totally well by having all these tests done. That's on a statistical basis. Someone looked at 12,000 routine serum calciums done on someone. 12,000, okay? And what they found was there were 627 that were abnormal, outside the 90. In other words, you have an abnormal calcium in your blood. Out of these 627, 17 had something that was wrong, had something erroneous with calcium metabolism. So the other 627, what did they get? Well, they probably got a repeat test, and it may have been positive. And then maybe or maybe not, they had somebody who used a little common sense and didn't go off the wall in investigation. Which isn't to say that it's wrong to get a serum calcium, but it is to show you the problems with simplistic thinking about blood tests and about intervention, which can, by statistical error, you know, just magnify things out of all proportion. Another thing is to point out is that these tests really are becoming a multi-million dollar business in this country today. Firms are putting out all sorts of diagnostic tests before they've been proven, and the tests that they use, it's interesting, when they write up a test a lot of times, and I'm indicting too much, I'm going overboard just to make a point, but a lot of the studies that are done show the test that they're trying to show is valid as being the only positive criteria for the disease. In other words, they make up a test. If someone has that, if someone tests positive, they have the disease, no one else has the disease, and therefore they show that their test tests for 100% positivity. This is misleading at best. And I mean, it's totally false information. So the other thing is that, another thing to look at is maybe that the doctor is looking out for your best health, or the clinic, or the hospital when they do some tests. And in fact, that's true to a point, but also medical people do get cuts of tests that go out. In other words, they get, for every test they order, as a rule, not always, and not in nonprofit clinics, but a private doctor or a private hospital gets a cut of a blood test that they do, or a urinalysis or something like that. So it isn't as if people don't make money off of these tests, even those who are concerned with your health, because they do. Again, that's not an indictment necessarily of the medical system. That's the way our whole system works. And it's just there's profit in it as well as altruism. Yeah.
You might mention malpractice, and that is that a lot of doctors think, well, they're going to get a full series of x-rays just to protect themselves. You know, maybe there's just a little doubt in their mind that you were doing, probably you need x-rays. If there's any idea at all that you might take x-rays to protect them.
That's right. That's a very good point. That's a little more done when someone has something wrong. For example, they bang their head, and you know they don't need a skull x-ray, but the doctor says, well, I'm afraid of malpractice, doesn't use his judgment and sends someone for a skull x-ray. But you're absolutely right. There's a lot of tests done to protect yourself, and that spirals costs and intervention too. Definitely true. Okay. The only other method I want to talk about, which is shown a lot in studies, is the idea that when you make a diagnosis early, that therefore when you make a diagnosis early and intervening, therefore you're prolonging someone's lifespan. And this is one thing that hasn't been done intentionally, but shows the necessity of knowing, like, the natural history of a disease, how long it takes from diagnosis to death. In other words, if somebody in 1965 is diagnosed as having a cancer of the bowel or of the colon, and they die at 1970, it doesn't necessarily mean because you made the diagnosis in 1964 that they're not going to die in 1970. You just may have made the diagnosis earlier. And all you've done then, in your paper, you write, well, there's a six-year survival, 1964 to 1970. Before, we only had a five-year survival, 1965 to 1970. Therefore, your intervention, your test looks better. This isn't true. And this is a concept of something called lead time of a disease. And that's sometimes difficult to ascertain. But the idea is to know, if you can, when a disease starts. For example, the biologic onset of a disease, which sometimes you can and probably can't ever establish. Some change takes place in a cell at a microscopic level. Then, say you screen for disease and detect the disease, okay, before anybody has symptoms. Then in the normal string of events, they get symptoms, and usually there's a little time before they go to the doctor or to the clinic, when they, at the time of diagnosis, and this is the time they die, here. So here's the spectrum. Now, SE, this minus SD, which is the lead time, right here. All this does, if you can't show that that's greater than this,
in this length of time here, in an unscreened population, you haven't done anything. All you've done is made your diagnosis earlier, told someone they have cancer for a longer period of time, and haven't increased their longevity at all. So you have to be sure on a test that by screening someone who's asymptomatic, that you can intervene in such a time, okay, that this period here is longer than that period in an unscreened population. Okay? Is that clear? That's a very important concept because a lot of articles fall down in that way where people say, I'm screening, I've got something, and I'm increasing longevity by 2 or 3 years. When in fact, all they may be doing is increasing the early diagnosis of the disease. Okay. Now, I gave you some handouts, which I don't want to go over if you want to look at. Those are just some screening things done at our clinic and also by a group called the Hunterton Group, Frame and Carlson in New Jersey, which is a family practice center. And what it does is, after all this talk about what isn't good to screen for, it shows that a lot of things are screened for and shows really the uncertainties and how much we still don't know and how much we do because, well, maybe it isn't bad and maybe it doesn't cost too much. All right, so I guess we're running out of time, but in conclusion, I just say that it's rather amusing that we again are aggressive about screening. I think that hypertension, given the present society, the way it functions, I think that hypertension is worth screening for. I think colorectal CA is cancer of the colon and rectum. I think you can do something about it that's easy to screen for. And certain populations, a test for syphilis, a VDRL, a PPD, a test for tuberculosis, tests for ova and parasites may in fact be beneficial in certain populations. Also, screening for obesity and smoking may be, if you can do something about it, may be important. But there's a whole spectrum, again, which is brought up earlier about telling people that they've got something which they don't have. And there was an article written about the importance of non-disease. It was written by a guy named Dudley Hart. And he's British, and I just want to read you what it says. He says, "The human frame varies immensely. Just look through your car window on Cup Final Night at the King's Road, Chelsea, on Saturday morning, and the infinite variety of human shapes and forms is immediately apparent." He says, "Two agitated parents brought their oddly shaped child to the outpatient clinic at Paddington Green Children's Hospital many years ago to see Mr. Clement Shattuck when I was his house surgeon. A lesser man would have done exhaustive metabolic and radiologic studies on this essentially normal child, and the worried parents would have welcomed them and suffered accordingly. All Mr. Shattuck said was, 'Mum, he's only got a lopsided conch,' and that was that, non-disease nipped in the bud." Well, there's a lot of non-disease in the population. There's non-cardiac disease. People have an abnormal EKG who are perfectly fine. There's non-dwarfism in people who are short. There's non-Cushing's disease in people who happen to have a lot of hair on their body. There's all sorts of non-disease for people who have been told that they have disease, and this is a bad, bad concept. So currently, there's a lot of unanswered questions about medical screening. Everywhere you read now, which are serious articles, they call for research and study into this problem. Yeah?
You just said there's a lot of unanswered questions about medical screening. To my satisfaction, you answered them all. It's not worth it.
I didn't mean to be so negative. I tried to show some of them that were worth it.
Yes, but I mean, why do you say that there are a lot of unanswered questions?
Because the same intensity and amount of money and amount of time hasn't at all gone into screening. That's gone into looking for rare diseases, for metabolic defects, into basic science screening. It hasn't been a major effort to look into prevention. And even though screening itself may not be the best avenue to go right now, I still think it's important to emphasize prevention and education over clinical diagnosis and over just taking care of sick people. And that's a point I want to make. We don't emphasize prevention. In medical school, we get it less in training and even less when we're out. There's very little money of the federal budget. I think less than 2% is put into preventive medicine. And preventive medicine is more than screening, but maybe we would find screening procedures which also show people are healthy, which can positively reinforce as well as find things by doing tests and by doing studies.
You can use any test for a baseline for improvement. Cholesterol can be lowered, weight can be lowered, blood pressure can be lowered. They can all be, you know, here's data now, 6 months from now.
Yeah.
You can look on a graph and see your cholesterol.
Right, right. So there's a lot of things by looking into that you could still do. And what I want to do is not totally pan screening, but just show that there's a lot of charlatanism in it and show that, in fact, there's a lot of things being propagated on the market that aren't worth it, that there are certain things to screen for that they should be done and looked at seriously, but that they shouldn't be screened for
without knowing why you're doing it, without having the test proven. And that screening can be valuable, even if we could incorporate it with a kind of a celebration of positivity and health, as well as just saying something's negative and isn't there. So what I want to do really is just end with a quote by, which is kind of non-political in nature and which doesn't go into the, which we can avoid the topics which I like to talk about. Earlier someone asked, what can we do to change this, the pill society? Well, I think that given the fact that we live in a society which probably rapes the environment, which pollutes, which offers us a lot of negative things towards health of our bodies, a society which still allows a lot of people to live under bad conditions, I think you'd have to ask that with or without good screening and with or without intervention, is the way to go to continue the present medical system? And I think, you know, in that situation, these are the questions one would have to address. And the answer to that may be yes and it may be no. There are always people who like to work within the system and those people who think it has to be changed. I have serious reservations whether this system will answer those questions, whether or not disease, which has been shown before, not to be the major advances in disease, for example, tuberculosis, infectious diseases, weren't made by doctors. They weren't made by medication. They were made by improvement in economic and social conditions. I mean, people like Illich write about this. It's becoming accepted now. There was better housing, there was clean water, there was sewage, and all of this led to the major advances. Not the fact that there were more MDs and not the fact that there was a medicine for tuberculosis. That curve is negligible. Same with penicillin in some diseases. What it was is that these other things occurred, public health measures, and that's what made a difference. But to end on something more or less apolitical, I would just say that, especially being an Arcosani, there's a very interesting quote and a very, very kind of enlightening quote by a man named Thomas who wrote in the New England Journal of Medicine about 5 years ago, and he said the following. He said, "We are paying too little attention and respect to the built-in durability and sheer power of the human organism. Its surest tendency is towards stability and balance. It is a distortion with something profoundly disloyal about it to picture the human being as a teetering, fallible contraption, always needing watching and patching, always on the verge of flapping to pieces. This is the doctrine that people hear most often and most eloquently on all our information media. We ought to be developing a much better system for general education about human health, with more curricular time for acknowledgement and even celebration of the absolute marvel of good health that is the real lot of most of us most of the time." So I think that may be an apt note to close on. Okay, thank you.
I'm with Bridges. This is Kathy Parker. Bridges is a business organization that is designed to promote health, happiness, and enthusiasm in other people by presenting and working with and contributing to seminars and workshops in communications and in personal development. It appears to us that people that are successful in whether their business or their interpersonal relationships or whatever seem to have two general characteristics. Number one, they seem to have an ability to get things started, carry them along, and watch the progress and bring them to a successful conclusion. Second key characteristic is that they have the ability to communicate. That is, the ability to send a message, to get people to listen to them, and make sure that they understand what the message was. Today, what Kathy and I want to do, in a short time that we have in this family communications kind of a setting, is to give you some things that you can take home with you that we feel that if you incorporate into your daily lives will bring about some positive changes in your family situation. Some kind of common things that are communication things that you're involved in on a daily basis are, for sure, in a family setting, kind of telling people what you want to get done, making sure they understand what you're talking about, and making sure that you understand that they understand. Second thing is, of course, is once they know that, there comes a time to evaluate. Have they done it? This has to do primarily with children, but for sure, even with husbands and wives, it makes a lot of difference. So evaluation requires a great deal of communication. Involved in that, of course, is sending messages that are positive. Gee, you did a great job. Really nice. Also, sometimes you have to send a negative message. And how you handle that, of course, really does affect the relationship that you have with your parents or with your children or children to children. So I think that we have some things to say about that. And I want to turn this over to Kathy, and we have some things I think that you can take home with you and use. Kathy.
Will she do a great job?
She'll do a great job.
Is that a prerequisite for this? Let me start out by saying that we're not talking about just a nuclear family. Okay, so those of you who are in communal living settings or single parenting, or you're just like a couple or two females or two males family, right? That's what we're talking about. So don't exclude yourself just because you think we may be talking about two kids and a mother and father who are married and living in a nuclear family setting. It's not accurate. We sort of think that Helen Reddy has something to say about communication. And although we don't want you to get hung up on the word against, we're going to play a recording of Helen Reddy. If you'd like to sort of close your eyes or do whatever you do to be in touch with yourself and listen to the words of music, I'd like to discuss this a little bit after we finish listening to the recording. And keep in mind that we're talking about units and bonding together, communication kinds of things.
Tell me again, Mommy.
There was something that is really quite positive. As Kathy said, I would de-emphasize the against that we think of in a setting like that. I think of it as a very positive message about someone who loves someone else and wants to build a relationship with them that makes them feel comfortable in all kinds of settings. Communication to me is the most important tool, or is the essential tool around which relationships are real. And to the degree that we do a good job of building that kind of communicating relationship, we build warmth and closeness and a desire to be with each other, and I think that's what she was saying.
Try this one, Nan. Kid comes home from school and says, I got sent to the principal's office today. To react to him. You what? What did you do now? You and me against the world? Mm-mm. Principal, me against you. Maybe the child has already done what he deserved, or she deserved, or they, you know, had sort of experienced the penalty. What about the husband that comes home and says, I really had a bad day. Serves you right, you got 15 minutes late. You and me against the world? World and me against you. I really think she has a message. I think it's something we can think about and work with, and in the family unit, if we have the kind of protection that we need, it then becomes you and me against the world. It's kind of a neat experience. I think it'd be very bonding. I'd like to really talk about some specifics. Positive messages are those messages that we don't communicate very often. We think of up here a lot, but we don't communicate them. I don't know why. I'm that way too. And when I do one of these seminars, I then go home and I'm really super for about 2 weeks. I really am tuned into the fact that I haven't done it in a while. Maybe I should put a sign up or something in my home. These are messages like, I really feel good when you offer me the dishes. I feel good. You know, I said, thanks. Or, it's really nice to come in and wake you up in the morning and find your room all straightened out. Instead of, what about the shoe a little bit? Negative messages we're really verbal with. We just give negative messages frequently. But I'm not sure we always give accurate negative messages. We know what we mean. I know why I'm mad, but do you know why I'm mad? Example that always hits home to me, because I think it just really is applicable to so many things, is the lady who is on her hands and knees scrubbing her floor. She's just finished waxing the whole floor. She looks at her watch and she realizes that the kid is late from school. It's also raining outside and she's been a long time on the floor, and just about that time the child comes slamming into the house and right across the wax floor, and she yells, get out of here! Can't you see what I'm doing? Get out of here! Now go! And the kid takes off. Where's the kid now? You know she's mad. Yeah. But why is she mad? He was late from school. Is that how come? Maybe. Slam the door. He's been told not to slam the door every day since he was 4. Slam the door. Maybe that's why she's mad. It's raining, and he got his shoes muddy. Perhaps that's how come she's mad. And she was down on her hands and knees. Maybe she had just done the floor, so he's got 4 possibilities. Which one's he going to pick? Okay. I think I've communicated very clearly. But have I? Probably not, unless I've been more specific. And even if I've been more specific, if I haven't given him an alternative behavior, how can I expect him to know what it is I want him to do next time? So tomorrow could be repeated again, and then I'm really going to get mad. I told you yesterday not to do that again. There was. I didn't slam the door this time. Simple example, but we do it all the time. The husband who comes in 15, 20, 30 minutes late, past time that you thought he was going to be there for dinner with a friend. And you're really angry, you say to him, in muted tones, and goes, I told you how mad that makes me. What? He forgot the bread you asked him to bring that morning. True. Brought a friend home, forgot to call you about, and he's 15 minutes late. And you're supposed to be able to tell him then what it is he did that made you mad, not just, I've told you before. Okay, can you help me out with some examples? Things that either you experience or you're involved in, as far as communication and giving those kinds of things? Is it clear? Okay. I see a lot of smiles, so I assume that you are probably relating to some of the things that I've said, either having given those kinds of messages or having received them. It's not any nicer to receive. What I want to do is state the 3 things that are necessary for a positive message and the 3 things that are necessary for a negative message if you're going to clearly communicate what it is that's happening for you. Now granted, there are a few things that we're taking, you know, for granted in here. Things like state the emotion you are experiencing. That's assuming that you're pretty much in touch with where you are. Because if you don't know what it is that you're feeling, it's going to be real difficult to get that across to somebody else. So Jerry and I prefer to deal with well people. People who are having a lot of psychological problems, people who are looking for therapy, should probably start somewhere else. We're assuming people are pretty in touch with where they are and feeling good about themselves, and then these things are applicable. All right, let's take the example. Husband calls and says, I'm going to be late, and I just wanted to call and let you know before you started dinner. And he comes in that evening, and she says, I really feel good that you remembered to call me and tell me you were going to be late. Didn't have to fix dinner and be angry. Real simple. She felt good. And what was it he did that triggered that good feeling? He remembered to call. There are two schools of thought, and you need to be aware of that on this third one. I don't buy the third one for positive communication. To me, that takes away the spontaneity. It goes something like this. Really feel good that you took the time to call me and let me know you were going to be late. Please do it again next time you're going to be late. And it loses me. There are some people who think it should be included. I do not. You can do what you like, okay? Because I'm hoping that you're going to write these down and take them home to use. Another example, say to a child, really makes me feel good when you offer to do the dishes. Thank you. That would be my way of saying it and using this particular component. This is what happens if you use the third one. I really feel good when you offer to do the dishes. Could you do that again tomorrow night? Do you see where I'm coming from? It just really takes it away from me. If I do something nice for someone and they give me that positive message and then tack that on the end, I'm going to say, forget it. I wish I hadn't done it this time. But it is. There are times when it isn't okay, and you're going to know that for yourself once you start using these as tools in your own communication kit. All right, let's go down here. Take the lady on the floor, waxing. Okay, kid comes in. Yelling is fine. I'm not suggesting that she should be very calm if she's not feeling very calm, or that she should not be angry. Work with whatever emotion it is that you are experiencing, but take it just a little bit further. I hate it when you come in the door like that and track mud all over the floor. Please go out and next time take your shoes off before you come in. Okay? Now, maybe she's too angry to communicate that right then. That's okay. Just do whatever. Scream. Do whatever it is you're going to do. But make sure that you go back later, and not a lot later if it's a young child, and say, I was really angry because I just waxed the floor. You came in and tracked mud all over it. Please, next time, take your shoes off the door. Okay, we still get the message. Question?
Would you also confine it to one element rather than including banging the door and other things in the same situation? Is there an advantage to concentrating on one?
I believe that there is. I think what happens, especially in children-related communication, what happens is you frequently lose the impact of what it is that you're initially feeling by saying, and furthermore. And pretty soon we're into a lecture. And what are they going to remember?
Another perhaps related question. How do you feel about doing the same thing and saying, clean up the mess you just made?
I think that that's a personal preference based on your child rearing or parenting style. I certainly buy that for my kids. I don't know. Some people aren't comfortable with that. I'm not sure if that's into communication or parenting skills. I think it sort of leans on parenting.
In effect, you're asking for responsibility to solve the problem someone's created.
No. I think what you're saying would do that, and I think that's okay. I think what we're doing is merely letting people know how to get across the initial message that they want to get across. Then there are a lot of avenues to go with it from there. Other questions? Okay. We'd like you to break into groups of three or four people. I want each one of you to come up with a positive statement and a negative statement, help each other out, do whatever, and we'll come back in just a few minutes to share these. This is because frequently it sounds okay up here, it looks okay here, and when you start putting it down, you find out there's some blocks, and I'd like to work with those blocks today. We'll give you the paper, so if you'll just move your chairs in three or fours, we'd like to work for a few minutes on this. Here. I would like
give me an example of a positive communication message and a negative. Yeah, maybe that was unclear. What I want you to do is actually be able to come up with a statement that is a positive statement and one that is a negative statement containing all the components, so that you can state the emotion. You're going to have to come up with a problem first, obviously, or you're not going to be able to come up with communication.
You can take that. There's one here.
Okay, well, that's good.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
if you remember back to your first dress.
No, what the hell does this mean? I can remember how put down that child was. Because she put a lot of effort into it.
Yeah.
It was nothing to say at the time.
It's still my bug, you know, whoever sees it.
The question is, though, what emotion was the person who said it feeling when they said it?
I expected you to make some
changes. What did the friend, well, like, did you say it or did somebody else say it?
Somebody else
said it. Did they feel jealous?
No, the person was feeling that it should have been perfect.
It's nice to be. Well, the emotion was one of criticism and disappointment.
But criticism's not emotion. I feel criticism, you know, I feel sad.
Yeah, we have sort of points of order here. the example is
a chosen one.
No, I think it's, but it happens so much. That's just it.
You could feel good.
You have a young girl who's just made her first dress.
And
a comment from another person to her parent early on. I guess the first comment she got on it from the person was that seemed as extreme. No, we were trying to figure out what emotion
and prayer that was. Instead of something like what a lot of work went into that.
Maybe the way to turn it around is to how she would communicate her feelings about that when someone spoke to her about it. Like, it really makes me feel sad that you took notice of the bad scene rather than the rest of the pretty dress. The next time I'll be here, you'd save your ugly comments for yourself.
Okay, that's fine. How about the person, though, who's feeling the disappointment wants to communicate that?
I guess, again, it's a matter of what you were trying to do and how you know, what the plan was. If it was advanced instructions and advanced specific instructions on sewing seams straightly, then that's probably one thing. If there hadn't been a lot of instruction given on it, well, probably you want to kind of take it anyway. But if you spend a lot of time talking about sewing straight seams, maybe you would say, it disappoints me that you didn't learn the lesson that I tried to teach you by sewing seams straight. Okay.
Oh,
next time.
We didn't have enough, I guess, in terms of the situation. Were you teaching? Was somebody teaching her about it?
No, it was a school president. Mm-hmm. But I remember the child was very sad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
Use this experience.
So it's a matter here of maybe our focusing on the emotions that she would feel.
Yeah,
kind of,
than
so what you're looking for is us to be able to control and express a negative feedback to someone.
We got a backside form.
Okay, well, in that case, you got a perfect example.
Right, exactly. Someone reads all said. And someone put her down on it. That's what she felt sad about. About being put down. She wished they wouldn't do anything.
How
Real hard for a kid to tell a parent, you know, hey, you really make them feel sad. Kind of.
Sure. Yeah.
Very.
Wish you wouldn't do that.
Well, this is the thing kids don't
tell you. What's the most important point is that you can, that they are amenable to education. If you educate them on the subject how to communicate better, it probably makes the relationship stronger.
Yeah, because we need feedback from kids.
Oh, really?
There are things we do to them that we don't know we're doing.
I'm getting feedback from my kids now, and they're saying, why didn't you? Why didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Why didn't you?
Yeah.
I think it's probably
why didn't you let me know how you felt?
Mm-hmm.
I took a course in being a subordinate.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, it was a course in being a leader, and half of it was in being a subordinate.
Yeah.
Because I find that the guy I'm working with, who is quote unquote my boss, although we're sort of on parallel levels, I have to teach him so long. It's funny what he doesn't know about being a leader. And I learned just from having been taught how to be a subordinate, one of the things is for in some ordered relationship where someone knows more or has been around more than you have to give feedback. And I was taught that as a child. So this is really simple. You could let your daughter know that you're receptive to her feedback.
Sure. Yeah.
That's what you should appreciate. No, we did this one in reverse too. I was feeling the positive that you noticed that, and my response is thank you for noticing it right now.
So you come also, we're sitting here feeling pleasure together.
Well, this one we got, the situation shall make you first address this good side to put down emotionally, put them in, put down and reach out.
I think we need to share the situation because he was looking for a positive and a negative communication. But what do you think of it? Don't you think we should?
Yeah.
Is it clear?
I think so.
Thank you.
To me, that the piece here is accuracy. I want to make sure that you have a clear understanding about what it is that's going to be the best combination.
Making independent
person to make sure they gave you plenty of attention and were listening carefully, and then recognize that they are actually listening. If you do that, then after a while, I think that it would be more attached against your relationship stronger, and maybe all kinds of wanting.
Does he ever offer to pay the gas?
Really hard.
You would like to be able to offer him a ride sometime without him having to.
How you perceive with the way
So then your response would be, that's your choice, would be, would be what? I don't like to be used all the time. You need to learn how to do that. Not quite direct, I realize.
Ellen, is your group about ready to come back? All right, this group got through first, so let's have you share a couple of things that you came up with. Everybody listen and see if you think they have all the components. Okay, this is a situation where we've worked out a job situation, and for instance, you're in a job situation and you're usually used to getting negative reinforcement, or, you know, please, you know, put the drywall up in or something like that. So your boss gives you a positive reinforcement, and so reinforce him. I'm feeling really good, and I appreciate your compliment today, because I work better when I feel it reinforced. Thank you. And then our negative, dug apart. Could make any sense? And then our negative situation was being in a noisy library, and we walk over to the person and we say, I'm feeling really aggravated, and I'm distracted by your loud talking, and could you please talk a little bit more quietly, or get the hell out of here? So, okay, how about this? All the parts? Okay, really important, as we talked to this group a minute ago, about owning the emotion. Really important, because if you go over and say, you really aggravate me when you're so noisy. Wow. Already got the finger out. Assigning behavior and all kinds of things. And they are not aggravating you. They're not, maybe what they're doing is triggering it for you. It's real important to get that in. If you start out trying to communicate that they are responsible, You already have a barrier. It's already there. Also, it's not good for you. Mm-hmm.
It seems like it would just put them on the defensive so much. You know, just right. That.
Okay. Good. Ellie, come back here.
Thank you, Roger. We didn't quite with a negative, but we came up right at the end. The problem of smoking and non-smoking is something that's really becoming an issue more these days. And I'm a non-smoker, so that most of my reaction toward the smoker is very negative. So a way to deal with that better than the way I've been dealing with it recently would be the idea that you say, you know, I'm very sorry, but I become very plugged up, you know, in a room with this many people, with this many people smoking. And I'd really appreciate if you'd make that your last cigarette.
I think we did. First of all, I don't like apologizing for you. And you're going to apologize, let's examine why.
Well, the problem with smoking, I always find is real cool. I mean, is that I never know where their right begins and my right ends, or vice versa. And a lot of people give me a lot of argument. What right do you have to tell me that I can't smoke? I have the right to smoke. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, it's me saying, but your smoke is coming into my eyes and my nose and my throat, and what right do you have of polluting my lungs for your enjoyment? So,
okay.
Sometimes by sort of apologizing for the fact that you don't like smoke, you disarm them a little bit so that they might cooperate by making that their last cigarette.
Okay, I hear where you're coming from. I would think that that might be something you'd want to clear up for yourself before you make that statement. Either you feel comfortable requesting, or you don't. If you do, I'm not sure an apology is necessary. Give me some feedback.
I think that that was his emotion necessary right off the bat. You know, everybody just feels aggravated around smoking. I do. I mean, I
don't. Yeah, so do I, but I really find if I come at it that way, then they just smoke twice as much. Mm-hmm. Because I've gotten them mad by saying that I'm aggravated because they're smoking.
I think in a way it's not so bad to say I'm sorry that I'm saying this because you're sorry that you're going to have to put a limit to their freedom. But as it is, they're stepping on yours and you want to start off now with the bombardment going on.
What that really is a qualifier. Communication. It's a qualifier. What you're really saying is, please, I'm going to hang with you. I'm not going to say it anyway.
How about saying that you're allergic to smoke and please do it somewhere else?
Yeah, I think lying is super.
You know, when you're in a meeting room with 13 people and you're closed up for 4.5 hours and 3 people are smoking.
I think it's one thing we're forgetting is that we're immediately going for behavior change here, whereas there, talking about just the way you felt about the thing that happened. And I think to like apples and oranges, we're going to get off a little bit.
I appreciate that, Stephen. I think that's accurate.
It just occurred to me.
Yeah, I think that is where it is. We're talking about third step is sometimes behavior change, but we've got to get the message across first. So maybe we can help Allie out as far as the statement would go. Let's say she's sitting in an office with three other people, and she can just say, I really feel uneasy sharing this, which is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's...
But I'm uncomfortable with the smoke. Would it be possible to have a smoking break in a few minutes? Because the room is really good. And that you're all three parts. And the qualifier is real upfront. You are feeling,
which is not really apologetic.
No, straight here.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that when you slip in that foot, that's real apologetic.
Yeah.
That's denying what's going on. You know, saying I'm really feeling going easy, and I'm real uncomfortable with you smoking these joints. You know,
yeah.
And that
really,
and that I don't think saying that necessarily is telling anybody what to do. It's just saying where you're coming from. If they want to act out on that and put out the cigarettes, or if they want to act out on it by blowing in your face, that's fine. But you're not saying, hey, do this. You're just telling them where you're coming from.
Yeah. Okay, so did you come up with that?
Well, we had lots of situations, but not really like
something. Okay, somebody else come up with it?
The positive one was I walked in here with some mint and I was smelling it and she noticed it and this actually happened. She said, thank you for bringing the mint. It smells good, and she thought of previous times in her life when she had limped around and had some good images about it. So that was our positive one.
Good.
The elements. The negative one was, a child making a dress for the first time. And the parents said to the child, the seam isn't exactly straight, something to that effect. And the response of the child, we had a little bit of difficulty with that when we started dealing with the parent, but then we switched to the child, and the child's response would be something to the effect, I put a lot of work in this dress, and I really don't like your criticism. Keep your comments to yourself. Something to that effect, in that case.
All right, this group has sort of done what the group in the back did, which is you jump to the second step. In initiating the communication, you want the initial response, which you can begin with the parent's response. Okay, not the way the person that you are communicating with would respond to you. That's a whole different step. One might be something like this. It infuriates me when you put your greasy hands all over the clean towels. Please wash your hands more thoroughly next time. I would if there had been some soap in your crummy bathroom. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're dealing with the second step instead of the initial step. Okay.
We had difficulty trying to figure out what the parent was feeling.
The child.
Yeah, it's the parents. It would be the parents.
Candy, would it not be equally appropriate to think about what the child would think? She's wanting to send them a negative message. Okay. I feel really sad that you didn't notice the rest of my dress and only paid attention to the seam. Okay. I wish you wouldn't do that the next time.
Mm-hmm.
Would that be an okay?
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense? Yeah. You're going through two steps to get there, right? You know, as far as situation is concerned. But if it's immaterial what the parent said, except that the parent did criticize the seam, then the child's reaction becomes what you're working with up here, or her communication.
You can turn in another positive by saying it's a beautiful little dress. The next one you make, it would be more beautiful if you got the seam.
You have to be real careful as far as manipulation is concerned. Okay, you know, one of the watchwords for those of us who are in the behavioral fields right now is what I hear you saying. And we use that all the time. Everybody's always saying that. Now, if you're real upfront, you say, what I hear you saying is that you're aggravated because I'm taking so long getting dressed and we're late. Maybe that's what the person just said. However, you can also say, what I hear you saying is that you're really angry at me. Hey. Okay, what you've done is you've built in your own ideas and biases on what that person is really saying, and you can use it as a manipulative tool. Just be real careful with that. Just make sure that you know when you're using it. It's okay to use it, but make sure you know that's what you're doing. Not clear communication. Okay, what about back here? Did you come up with
anything
you'd like to share?
Okay, we got a positive negative. Half a week ago, I invited this guy to come along with us from California. So he says, I feel good you invited me, and my response would be, you're welcome, and I'll be sure to ask you again next.
Okay.
And your negative would be like, you're a sweet guy. Comes home from work and says, darling, here are some yellow carnations for you. The wife automatically says, oh, you know I don't like yellow, or you know I have it on the red.
Okay, what we're really talking about, your first one is positive. When you gave two positives, and that's good. You gave a positive one, which was, thank you for inviting me to the trip, on the trip, okay? Or I feel good because you asked me on the trip. You've got both. I feel good because you asked me on the trip. And the second was, you're welcome. I'll do it again. And so that was two positive messages, and that's good. The second one is usually comes up when we do a group like this. You're talking about a negative response rather than negative communication. All right? A negative response would be just exactly what you stated. The guy brings in the flowers and says, here they are. And she says, I really hate yellow. But that's a negative response, but it's not negative communication. Negative communication is like three component sort of thing. Let's see if we can make that into a negative message instead of a negative response. Okay, a negative response would be, let's assume the husband really does know she's allergic to flowers. Okay, and he brings them home. Negative response, he brings them in the door and she says, I'm really feeling angry. You chose to bring me a gift
but you know I'm allergic to flowers. And you might want to tag the ink one on then. Please don't do that again. Okay, what did he do? What is she feeling? I'm really feeling angry or hurt. Maybe hurt would be more accurate. I'm really feeling hurt. Because you chose to bring me a gift and it's flowers, and you know I'm allergic. So what did he do? And what would she like to, you know, have him do in the future? That's a little far out. The guy's probably really telling her something if he knows that she's allergic to flowers and he chose to do it.
He wanted to make her angry and she got angry. Yeah. That's positive reinforcement.
That's where it is. Really. Okay. Time is sort of up on this part of it. Any of you who would like to be on Bridges mailing list, we're going to hopefully be offering a full course on family communication and lots of other things too. If you'd like to be on the mailing list when we get the brochure completed, which should be in the next couple of weeks, we'll send them to you in the mail. For those of you who are out of town, Jerry and I love to travel. We don't have any hang-ups about California. If you want to copy these down or do not have paper with you, feel free to tear some off the bottom here so that you've got these. One thing that might be fun to do is to take it home and share in whatever family situation you find yourself. Sit down and make it a family project and say, went to Arco Santi and I learned something I thought we might try. Let's see what we can come up with. Kids can learn that. It's not difficult. All you have to do is take them through the same steps we went through here and they start coming up with some really good ones and it's kind of fun. Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.